1947, NASA launched the last of America's deep space probes. Aboard this compact starship, a lone astronaut, Captain William Buck Rogers, was to experience cosmic forces beyond all comprehension. In a freak mishap, his life support systems were frozen by temperatures beyond imagination. Ranger 3 was blown out of its planned trajectory into an orbit 1,000 times more vast, an orbit which was to return Buck Rogers to Earth 500 years later.
Hello.
Hello.
How's it going?
Pretty good.
Just got done recording a DC Noise Bites Futures End with CK. Ran a little long.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because we had two issues to talk about because we missed last weekend.
Oh, okay. Was it 4 and 5?
Yeah, 4 and 5.
Cool.
Yeah. Had a last minute discussion about New Gods toys, so it took a while.
Nice.
There's a Mentron, and I didn't know there was. It was like released as a signature series, and now I have to seek it out.
Yeah, I think
it comes with the Mobius chair. It's awesome.
Yeah, from the Club Infinite Earths.
Yeah,
I think it was. I think there was also a Metron in that series that DC directed, right?
I don't think so.
Oh, really? Cause
yeah, there was an Orion, a Light Ray, Mr. Miracle, and Big Barda. It's like a three-pack. I think an Oberon's in there, too.
I know there were two series of them.
There was the Kirby versions, and then there's the regular versions.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Cool.
Cool deal. All so right, that, let me make sure my transition. Recorder is going here. It did two back-to-back recordings. Hopefully it'll work.
Yeah, it's going to burn out on you.
Yeah.
Start smoking.
All right, I need to grab a pen so I can write notes.
I believe in miracles. Where are you from?
You could play that song while Buck Rogers and Aaron Gray are dancing around that pole.
Yeah.
Those are some fucked up dance moves, man. I swear to God.
I don't know if it's disconcerting to find out that in the future, disco will be back.
Yeah, that's right. In roller skating.
Everything comes back, I guess.
Yeah.
I got Luna here with me.
All right.
Did you read any old comics, Luna? She said she's mostly been into new stuff lately.
Ah, just didn't read any old stuff. Damn.
Image number ones.
There's sure a lot of those fuckers.
I know.
I gotta start. The only thing that I don't mind is I buy so many fucking comics, but I don't. It seems like their monthly growth isn't exponentially growing. And what I mean by that is, like, you might have one title go on a hiatus and replaced by something else, and
mm-hmm.
You know what I mean. Like maybe Savage Dragon ain't shipping this week, or you know stuff like
right.
that.
Yeah, like the fact that they're launching 5 or 6 number ones every month, you'd think that they would end up by the end of a year like with like 50 ongoing titles, but that's not like that. It kind of stays the same amount.
Yeah, it's kind of like a steady state. Like Saga goes on hiatus, so something else takes its place.
Mm-hmm.
And then Saga comes back, and then that mini's dropped out. So I don't know. It's
yeah, and then you got... Some of the number ones are limited series or if they're ongoing. Like most Image, besides things like Savage Dragon, Walking Dead, Spawn, stuff like that, a lot of Image ongoings do have an endpoint, you know?
Yeah.
Like Chew is an ongoing, but I think after about 50 or 60 issues, it is going to end, so.
Yeah, and that one's not even always monthly solicited.
Yeah, I think, I want to say though, I mean, a lot of the series are the bigger series that they have, like Saga and Revival and stuff, they might do about 10 issues a year, I want to say, or
Yeah, it's
something
like
like
they
that.
do five and then take a break, and then they do another five and then take a break, and
The nice thing about that, I think, is that usually in that break month they release a trade. So you could get the trade, read it, and then you're good to go for the next issue that comes out.
Yeah.
Instead of having to backtrack a couple issues that you missed or something.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, we could probably start talking Buck Rogers this time. I think last time we sort of stuck it in at the end if you want.
Sure, that sounds good to me.
This one was called Cruise Ship to the Stars, and it aired on December 27th, 1979. I was, let's see, like 9 months old. So I don't remember watching this.
I remember it. 'Cause the only thing I remember about this episode, 'cause it was so damn long ago, is the girl with the powers. I didn't
Yeah.
remember that it was the same character, split personality character.
Yeah, so I have some notes on some of the people. We actually mentioned this episode a couple episodes ago, 'cause one of the main stars is a Playboy playmate, former Playboy playmate named Dorothy Stratton, and we talked about the Star 80 movie that was made about her life. She
She
was
was smoking in this. God bless. She was. She even was acting as the perfect, like the perfect clone woman, or Miss Cosmos had no flaws. Like she was a beauty queen that had no physical flaws.
Yeah, she probably would have been a really big household name, I think. So as I said, this came out in December, almost the end of the year. She had been the August 1979 playmate, so a few months prior to this coming out. And she'd also got some other TV roles and things like that off of being the playmate. And actually, a few months after this, she was announced as the 1980 Playmate of the Year, reflecting kind of that popularity. And she was actually about less than 8 months after this episode aired was when she was killed.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, so she had been involved with a guy named Paul Snyder back before she was ever a playmate. He, I think, actually sent some of her photos in, and he was kind of like a hustler, a pimp. He was 5 or 6 years older than her. She was 20 when she died. And he was a real bad personality, real bad hangers-on. Like, at least according to the movie, you get the impression that people that she met as she started to become famous really picked up on the fact that, she should distance herself from this guy and he was no good.
Yeah.
But it took her a while to get to that point. They actually got married, but by the time she was killed by him, they weren't together. Like, they were estranged. They weren't officially divorced, but she was kind of seeing the director Peter Bogdanovich and working on a movie of his. But in the movie Star 80, he's played by a character that has a different name because he wouldn't agree to have his name included in the film. Yeah, it was pretty brutal. I mean, Snyder raped and killed her and reportedly like did some things to her body after that, and then shot himself in the face with a shotgun.
Wow.
So not to bring things down, but But she was a beautiful woman. She was the definition of the brick house.
It almost sounds like that movie that I just watched for DC Noise with the porn star. It was like a biographical movie made about her.
Oh, you mean Lovelace?
Yeah, Lovelace, because that guy was an ass too. Almost like the same personality traits that you were just mentioning. He even was like selling her to as a prostitute to make money, to make his own money, and that was his own wife.
Yeah, it was. I haven't seen that movie, but
But
I do know that story.
it's very similar to the it's what you're kind of describing, at least the personality of the husband. I've seen Star 80, but God, it's been so long ago, and when I saw it, I didn't absorb anything except for the titties. Like I saw it when I wasn't an adult. I saw it when I was, oh man, but, at that time you're not absorbing the content of the storyline. You're like, boobies.
It's as it was in real life. I mean, the ending is pretty shocking,
Yeah.
but we also had you mentioned that there's a character that is kind of a Jekyll and Hyde sort of personality. The good kind of half character named Kimberly Beck. She's played by Alison Michaels.
She's been in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, the one prominent thing, the whole phenomenon of the final girl in horror movies, like the character that doesn't get killed, that survives, and it's usually a female. She was the final girl in Friday the 13th, the final chapter.
Oh, wow.
And then the other half of her, Sabrina, she is played by Tricia Noble. She's Australian, I guess, and she's a singer and actress. She's been a lot of different stuff, but one thing I noted that was kind of like a geeky thing was she actually played Padme Amidala's mother in episode 3.
That is interesting.
Yeah, which would have been a long time from this episode. And finally, the guy that is associated with the two of them in the movie or in the episode, J. Lee McCloskey is the name of the actor. He plays a guy named Jay.
He looked like a
That's
porn star.
her boyfriend. Yeah. He. I thought it was interesting that in addition to being an actor and like in a lot of different like small TV roles and stuff like that, I guess he's a big artist. Published a lot of books of like illustrations and stuff.
And
It was kind of neat to find out, but.
wasn't Tina the little Twiggy?
Yes, Tina.
What she said, booty, booty, booty.
It's instead of bitty bitty bitty,
It's
she said booty booty booty.
booty, booty, and she said it really slow, like it was like booty, booty, booty.
Yeah. That's what she wanted to give Twiggy.
A lot of booty.
Yeah, she was. I should have noted the name because there was a an actress that was inside, just like there's in Twiggy.
Yeah.
There's a real person
That
in
guy was
there.
pretty popular. The one that played Twiggy, anyway. He was just on Toy Hunter recently because he hired the Toy Hunter to seek out his action figure
Cool.
in mint condition. A mint
Nice.
condition Twiggy.
Yeah, we saw a picture of him in the costume without the helmet.
Yeah.
Norbert Franz, who was on a few episodes ago, he posted it to Facebook. That was pretty cool. Okay, so the actress name that plays Tina is Patty Maloney. She's currently 78 years old, still with us. Began her show business career at age 3, performing on Broadway. And she's done a lot of animation voice work.
Booty, booty, booty.
And was in Ernest Saves Christmas
That
as two of Santa's elves. So that's interesting. Oh, she was Lumpy in the Star Wars holiday special. Interesting. It's just crazy how I always find it fascinating to look at IMDb or look up actors and actresses on Wikipedia and see all the different things that they've been in and you, these weird connections between stuff that you like that you didn't even realize was there.
Yeah.
You know? So, while getting into the episode then, so Dorothy Stratton that we've talked a bunch about, she plays Miss Cosmos. And so she's the perfect woman, physically and emotionally, everything. And we meet her in the beginning of the episode, and she's attacked by a dark-haired woman who turns out to be Sabrina, the darker half of this kind of Jekyll and the Hyde character. And then we check in with our regular cast, with our heroes. And they are actually playing poker. Buck and Wilma and Twiggy and Doctor and everybody. And
Twiggy wins.
Twiggy wins. He says, "Come to Papa." And Buck remarks that it's kind of like losing to a typewriter.
Then he mentions like I'll introduce you later to shuffleboard or something like that. I like all those like callbacks. They're so ridiculously crazy.
Yeah, they no one's heard of shuffleboard in the future, and Buck's getting used to this phenomenon at this point, but he just says something along the lines of another tribal custom bites the dust. But not surprisingly, when Buck finds out that they may need someone to go protect the perfect woman, he's quite interested in volunteering to do so.
It's really a cool sci-fi concept because we've seen some of this stuff in comics and in books and movies where you have like perfect human being and in this one they're trying to capture her so they can clone another perfect human being, right? Or they're trying to get like samples and actually capture her and get blood samples and take whatever organs it talks about like their organs on the black market are worth a lot of money.
Yeah, they want to get into Miss Cosmos' genes. Or, I
Yeah.
mean, they want a sample of her genes.
I
But,
wouldn't mind getting into her jeans either.
fortunately for us, she didn't really wear any jeans at any point in this
Yeah,
or
the
wear
first
that much.
outfit was sexy. It was really awesome.
So pretty much just wears bathing suits and stuff throughout the episode, but
Yeah, but they're on a cruise ship.
yeah.
And the cruise captain is trying to protect her because it's big publicity for him to have her on board.
Yeah, and
It's like
there's a very
the
tropical,
love boat in space.
pretty much, yeah, because it's got a very like tropical kind of feel to it, and
Yeah, and
there's a big swimming pool,
he's
and
like Captain Steubing.
yeah. That's what they should have just called it,
The love boat.
love boat in space, love ship,
Cruise ship love.
cruise ship to the love.
Yeah,
But so everyone's hanging out in some like pretty skimpy, crazy, futuristic bathing suits and stuff. You got guys walking around in like in speedos with like glitter on them and stuff.
it's very, very interesting time because men's physiques were really shitty. I mean, in today's standards,
They
they're
were
either stocky or
more
really
realistic.
thin, yeah, and like fat hanging over their trunks. You know what I mean? It was more realistic. Just like the women, they weren't like overly thin; they were well fitted.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about why I'm a big fan of 70s movies and stuff, because you could, like, talking about male actors, like, you could have male actors that were just downright unattractive. And they could be leading actors, or they could just be average. Like, even if they weren't straight up ugly, like
Yeah.
you could have leading actors that weren't attractive, you know?
Yeah, it's unusual. In today's, it's unusual. Back then, it wasn't.
Yeah, and I mean, I think at this, I mean, you would see Buck Rogers as being attractive, but
But
like
his physique is not,
it's more natural.
it's a more natural kind of stocky physique. It's not like a thin, abs, that kind of physique. It's more of a natural, somebody you would see lounging on a lounge chair near the pool and showing his man boob.
You saw a lot of that too in decades prior to the 70s too. I mean, I always think like Sean Connery
Yeah, that's right. Bond.
as Bond. You know, I mean, he had much more of a he didn't have fat on his body really, but he was much more of a stocky kind of guy.
Yeah, it was more of a normal looking person rather than Hollywood looking. But I'm
Or
still.
even some of the ones that were Hollywood looking, like the guy, they had more of like a stocky build, the
Yeah, they
guys,
did.
you know.
We didn't know how to exercise our abs back then. We didn't know there was an ab machine or.
Every actor didn't have, you know, this regimented training program and trips to get their chest hair waxed.
And they never had a chance to get like any kind of exercise in a fight scene because they'd have a stunt double come and throw a punch.
The simplest thing.
And also on this ship is Erin Gray. She's always like Buck's opposite, and they're not usually working together, but she's undercover too.
Yeah,
I
that's
love the
true.
scene where she's with the menage a trois and they're dancing with string. She's like dancing with two guys, and she looks like she's gonna get it on with both of them.
Yeah, she comes into the scene where they're all hanging out in the pool area on the ship, and Twiggy comments, "Wilma's looking pretty foxy." And she does look nice, but I wasn't a fan of her different hair here.
Her hair was older looking, I
She had a
think.
short perm, like it
Yeah,
was like all up on top
it's
of her
very
head.
weird. But the dress was nice because it showed like a lot of leg. It was like a blue dress, but again, it had the cut way up to the thigh. I dig those things.
Yeah, she was still attractive because she's got such a pretty face, but yeah, I wasn't a fan of the hair. She
Yeah, it was weird.
But there is a guy that is a fan of it that immediately comes after. He smacks her in the face with his chest hair. Or almost does. But she plays hard to get just to draw him in a little bit more because that's what she's trying to do. And Buck is watching this all happen and he comments, "Put out the honey and you draw as many flies as bees." And he's got Dr. Theophilus with him sitting there on the table, the little computerized thing. And Theophilus is getting sick of him using all these
Things he
earth
doesn't
sayings and
understand.
stuff. It's like, I just wish that you would
Talk
talk
normal.
normal.
Well, he's a machine and he takes whatever he says as meaning. Like, and a lot of the sayings that Buck say, you stream them together and it makes no sense to him, and it frustrates him.
Yeah, he's
And
not programmed for it.
Twiggy, and then the person who brings drinks is Tina, and she's like a female robot that's gold, and she looks like Twiggy. And booty, booty, booty.
He says, "Hold the phone," when
I
he sees her. And then they talk a little bit in English, but then they drop into their robot speak.
like that because it's like, hey, baby, you want to see something?
Yeah, they don't want to talk it. They don't want Buck to understand what they're saying
Yeah,
anymore.
they're
So they
talking
drop into
nasty.
bitty, bitty, bitty. Booty, 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 bitty, 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 booty, booty, booty. So meanwhile, we find out that this woman that we saw attack Miss Cosmos at the beginning of the episode, we see her transform into a blonde-haired woman. Just after this transformation, Buck runs into her in one of the hallways in the cruise ship. And she looks a little distraught, so he helps her back to her cabin. She explains, you know, she's here on the cruise to rest and relax and try to That she's not hasn't been feeling well, and so she's gone on this cruise like a lot of people have done to try to just get some relaxation and start feeling better. So he takes her back to her cabin, and this is where he meets Jay, who says he's her boyfriend. And you could tell, Buck says, I can go get the captain, the ship's doctor. I can get the ship's doctor if she's not feeling well. And Jay brushes that off, says, we've gone to all kinds of doctors. Obviously, a cruise ship doctor's not going to be able to do anything. And he just kind of gives him the brush off. And you could tell that from Buck's expression that he's immediately suspicious of this guy.
Yeah, he's kind of like that asshole.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of interesting that he's in an episode with Dorsey Stratton in it, because.
Yeah, 'cause he's like real possessive of her.
And he's
But
using her.
he's only possessive of her because he's using the other personality to get what he wants. 'Cause she has powers. And he's treating this one like, "Hey, baby, I'll take care of you." But then she transforms and they like plot together because she's like the evil part. There's like a good and evil to this character.
Yeah, and the good part, he's always discouraging her from, is a very classic, like, manipulative personality where he's discouraging her from doing anything for herself, and says that he's helping her get better, but he's really just kind of keeping her in place and keeping her under his thumb.
Right. She's only on that shit. He tells her. She's on that ship so she could try to heal. Like, it's like a healing experience for her to get better. And it's really not. It's so they can capture this beauty queen.
Right. And so when she transforms back into Sabrina, Sabrina is compliant to a degree and was working with Jay, but she's gotten her eye on, she saw Wilma out in the common area, and Wilma's got some huge ass bling around her neck, and Sabrina wants the jewels. So they fight about it a little bit. Jay's just wants to focus on Miss Cosmos, but Sabrina's not going to help him get and use her powers to get Miss Cosmos unless she can also go after Wilma's jewels. So he eventually agrees to let her do that. So there's a earlier when Buck met Allison and Jay, he mentioned that he'll see them later because there's a dinner time on the cruise ship and everything, and Buck comes out in pretty much just a modern day to us looking tux, and people are just pointing at him and laughing at him because it's not proper futuristic looking. And then he sits down to a meal, and Dr. Theo introduces him to the technology that they have there to eat. It's this thing, weird thing called a gravity fork.
Looks like a knife.
Yeah, instead of using a fork or a knife to pierce the food and move it up to your mouth, you just point it at the food and it sucks the food up to it. I don't know what difference that makes really or how much it helps, but it's one of those things like they're just showing you the show like, hey, check out this futuristic thing. But it's pretty funny. And Twiggy and Tina show up, or actually Twiggy shows up first, and there's a discussion about how Twiggy's spent a lot of time with Tina, and that his interest in her is pretty much just physical. And he says, "You better believe it." And then when she shows up, Tina shows up, they have a date to go down to the dance room level. So, to find out if she's ready, Twiggy looks at her and says, "Are you hot to trot?"
They go dancing and he gets wasted. He
Yeah.
gets exhausted.
I know later on,
How does a
like,
robot get exhausted? I don't know.
"Twiggy, are you okay?" And he's totally wiped out. He's just leaning his head against the wall, not moving. So he wore himself out somehow. But so Buck is about to head down to the dance room as well, and he's not taking Dr. Theo with him. And so Dr. Theophilus says to Buck, "Can you please turn me before you leave a little bit in the to the left?" And Buck's like, okay. And Theo says, I need a circuitry. It helps with my circuitry realigning. And Buck looks in the direction that he just pointed Dr. Theo and realizes that he's pointed Dr. Theo in the direction of Miss Cosmos. So the perfect woman can even get computers attracted to her.
Worked up, yeah.
Yeah, he wants a nice view.
They can't help it, their resistors get warm.
Yeah, so we get to, we get to the dance room, which this is what you were talking about earlier, which is hilarious. One thing we see Twiggy and Tina dancing together, and Tina's actually got a feather boa thrown around her neck. So that's her dance. She got dressed up for dancing, and Twiggy knocks into her with his hip and says, "They call this one the bump." But yeah, there's like a bunch of couples dancing, and they're doing this weird dance where the guy's holding a rope around the woman, and the woman's like interacting with the rope and moving it around and stuff. And
It is very weird.
Wilma's in there, and everybody, it must be, I gotta try this dance because if based on the faces of the people that are doing it, it is like very awesome dance
You
because
should do it
everybody
at
is
a wedding.
super happy. Yeah,
It's your wedding. You
that's
should tell.
true.
You should study the moves, and then have, you would freak everybody out if you did that.
Oh my gosh. I know. That'd be awesome.
And then you could
We could
wind.
do it for our like our solo dance.
Yeah, and then when at the end, what you could do the posts. You could put posts on the dance floor, and then you touch the post, and you touch the other hand on the post, and I just thought that was goofy.
Yeah. I'd be like, what the hell is going on here? This is the Buck Rogers. This is the futuristic dance, people. But yeah, they're all very super. They have the biggest smiles on their faces that I've ever seen, including Wilma. That's a pretty awesome dance, I guess.
Yeah, she's got jewels around her neck.
Yeah, huge,
Huge jewels,
huge jeweled necklace.
and the goal of those jewels are try to lure that powerful woman out to try to steal the jewels, and it
Yeah, but
works.
Yeah, they say at one point that they're Damoebian moon crystals. So I guess those are good. But it turns out actually Sabrina is a little smarter than Wilma realizes. She knows that the woman that Wilma supposedly is supposed to be, as she's telling people that she is on the cruise ship.
She knows she's not that, she's falsifying her identity.
Yeah, because the real one, she knows who the real person is, and that person is 82 years old. So,
That was bad research on Wilma's part.
yeah, she screwed that
Maybe
up a little bit.
she screwed the pooch. Maybe if she would have made herself look older instead of just get a perm.
Yeah, I was gonna say maybe in the future that's a sign that you're old, that you have hair like that.
I don't know.
But so Buck has got more and more involved with Allison trying to help her out. He realizes that something is going on with her, and he hasn't completely figured it out yet, but they're getting there and realizing there's definitely something up with Allison, and she's not just ill in like a normal kind of way. And Allison, the actress that plays her, Kimberly Bell, she's a pretty actress. As the episode goes on, it's the role she's supposed to be playing, but for a while towards the end here, her main tone is to be distraught and upset, about everything that's going on. So most of her lines for the latter half of the episode are all kind of delivered in this kind of high-pitched whine. In particular, she has this one line where it almost sounds a little off tone, where She yells, "I'm having nightmares with my eyes open." But they're so Jay and Sabrina are ready to make their move on Miss Cosmos. And twice whenever they're going on their mission, Jay gets dressed up in this hilarious outfit where he's got a white jumpsuit on and that he pulls the hood over his head and puts on these dark glasses. And he just looks ridiculous. I don't know why, I don't know if anyone really knows him on the ship in the first place, but I guess that's his disguise. I guess he's trying to protect his identity. But they've
I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, the Woody Allen, Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex, or maybe it is that one, but where they're Woody Allen's a sperm.
Oh
It
yeah.
look that outfit disguise looks like one of the sperm outfits when they're like in the testicles and they're bouncing around. I
And
just
it's like head to toe white suit.
yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
It looks like the sperm outfit from that Woody Allen movie.
Yeah, basically it does. You're right.
All
Just add like add.
I needed to do was jump up and down like a sperm moving around.
He might as well be. He looks pretty ridiculous. But Buck confronts them, but they have Wilma, so they threaten Wilma's life, and he has to let them go. And by this point, Dr. Theophilus has figured out that Alice and Sabrina are the same person. He calls them a transmute, and they know that Sabrina has these powers. Buck asks Earth to send Dr. Huer to send some earplugs, some like specialized earplugs and sonic weapons that they can use to combat her. And while they're waiting for those to arrive, Buck gets Wilma, and they're able to sort of set up a confrontation with Alice and Jay when they're hanging out, not down near the dance floor, one of the tables near the dance floor. This is where we see Buck and Wilma doing the dance you were talking about
Yeah.
earlier. Allison at this point, she wants to just leave altogether, and Jay lies to her and says that the cruise won't let people leave an unscheduled stop. So they're gonna basically antagonize Allison and get her upset. So betting that that will cause her to turn into Sabrina, and if they can get both Allison and Sabrina angry at Jay, and have Sabrina attack Jay, that'll take him out, and they'll be able to use the earplugs and the weapons that they now have to subdue her. So the end of the episode is pretty much them running through this plan, which is successful, and they're able to subdue her. They'd kind of just trap her by using the weapons, so she doesn't really have anywhere to go. Everywhere she turns is one of our team with their weapon, and they're able to rescue Miss Cosmos, who by this point has been captured and strapped to a table. And as they get ready to, I don't know if they're just going to take like a sample of her tissue or what they're going to do, but they're getting ready to
I think
basically use her
organs are
body.
involved.
Yeah, I think it might be something pretty severe that they're going to.
Because it's like a surgery that'll definitely kill her.
Yeah.
It's not just like taking blood samples.
Yeah. So at the end, Miss Cosmos and her bodyguard and Buck and Wilma are all hanging out by the pool, and Dr. Huer tries to tell them through their communicator that it's time for them to head back to Earth, and they pretend that the communication is interrupted and that they didn't hear him tell them to come back so they can stay on the cruise ship.
Yeah, it's the famous scene where you pretend you like make the fake sounds like
Yeah.
I can't hear you. It's
Come
static.
what?
What?
Yeah. Mike, what? I. You. And Twiggy says, Now we can get it on.
Like Twiggy, he knows what it's about.
Yeah. So he's gonna spend some more time with Tina.
I just wanted them to play some Barry White at the end there.
Yeah. Twiggy press a little button on his chest or something and start playing Spotify.
Yeah. It was a good episode.
That's what I do sometimes.
Another winner.
I don't press a button on my chest, but I put Spotify on my phone and put the phone in my pocket, and I got walking around with pocket music, I call it.
Oh, you don't have a headset on?
No, I mean, well, sometimes I do, but if I'm just
You
walking around,
just walk around with music in your pocket.
sometimes I walk around the house and mute my
That's awesome.
pocket music for pocket time, pocket pool.
Cool deal.
So.
Yeah, that was a good episode, another winner. And I like when I have an episode where I can laugh and enjoy the plot.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, we've had some that have been decent, but I would say this is one of the better ones.
Yeah.
It was pretty good. It's just so hilarious, sometimes intentionally and sometimes unintentionally, but there's not a lot like it.
Yeah.
But.
It's a weird sci-fi show. It's very sexual.
Yeah, definitely.
God bless whoever decided this idea, because
That 70s kind
yeah, the
of.
70s and the way that they designed the outfits and stuff, it's definitely very sexual. It's weird too, is the men's outfits, like Buck, let's say he's in his starfighter uniform. It's very tight. Like it like clings to his body, like there's no room to sag at all.
Yeah, there's definitely
And in today's world, you would be frowned upon if you wore tight clothing
a
and you were not of a good physique.
Right.
I don't mean a good physique. I mean a perfect physique. I guess that you would say.
Right. Yeah, clothes back then were definitely, you didn't really have baggy style. Baggy clothing hadn't come into style at any point
I
yet.
am really looking forward to the next episode because that's the one I remember most in my mind.
Space
Space Vampire.
Vampire. And then after that, we have one called Happy Birthday Buck, and it was, and I mentioned that because it was written by Martin Pasco,
Wow.
comic book writer.
That's true.
And actually, he wrote one of the comics I'm going to talk about today. I should have
Cool.
saved it for a
It's
couple episodes from now if I'd known that.
a link.
Yeah, link to the future in the past. Something.
You wanna? I don't know if we got questions. I know you posted something, but
Yeah, I'll double check, but I didn't get I have a notification popped up that we got comments, so just double check
I
here.
was just too overwhelmed with podcasts this last 24 hours. We had 4 hours last night, and then another 45 minutes before this one, and just didn't have time to get the question thing out.
Yeah, and are you recording any more after this or?
No, I'm done. Th
Okay.
th th this is, for the most part, my last podcast for the month of June with other people.
Yeah, you're gonna try to fit in some bites.
Oh, the bites are easy though. I could do
Yeah,
those
'cause you
like
can
at
do
my
those.
and on my own. I could do those at night or after work or whenever I feel like it. It
Yeah,
could
I
be
guess so.
when my teeth hurt in the middle of the night or whatever. I
Yeah.
gotta get that root canal, man. The doctor says he wants it's I don't need it, but I kind of my body's telling me, hey, get that root out. So,
I
what
had a
thoughts?
little, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say I had a little thing removed from my neck It wasn't anything serious. It was
It
kind
was
of like,
just a benign cyst or whatever.
yeah, some kind of like a. He said that it could have been one of two things, and one of them, it wasn't. Oh, it's not a wart, but it's similar to a wart, and he didn't really know exactly. But I had it for quite a while, and I kept. It was right at the base of my hairline in the back,
Yeah.
so I kept like I kept touching it and kept picking at
Yeah,
it.
like when you're combing your hair or something.
Yeah, and I just like when I'm sitting, I was sitting at work. Like, I get, you know, when I'm not thinking about it, my hand would go back there and just start scratching it and stuff.
Yeah.
So he took it off, the pathology report came back, and they said it was actually growing into a baby Keith Knudsen.
Does he hate the new 52?
So it was
That was the part of you that hates the new 52.
yeah, it was so now I'm all in.
Yeah. As
It
soon as
took
you had it
any
removed,
reservation, yeah.
you're
And
starting to read
for some
stuff.
reason, yeah, I haven't been as flatulent. I don't know if that's connected or but they were asked me if I wanted to see a picture, and I said no, that'd be a little too frightening. No, he said that if it was anything, he'd be pretty shocked.
Yeah.
And it didn't look like it didn't have that red discoloration around or anything like that. Because I keep an eye because I do have like a bunch of moles.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're
Like the
supposed to
mole
keep an
man.
eye on them. Yeah. My eyesight is probably as good as the mole man's.
Really? You don't have to wear glasses or anything?
I have contacts.
Oh, okay, that's
Yeah.
not that good then.
No, yeah, my eyes are pretty bad. I'm nearsighted, but I'm so nearsighted that if I didn't have my contacts in, I would have to hold a comic like right up to my face
Yeah.
to read it.
And I've had bad luck with teeth. I've had ever
I have
since my
too.
root canal, I mean my wisdom teeth removal. It went from wisdom teeth to another root canal to a bone infection in my jaw. And now, I think it was a popcorn kernel when I was watching Amazing Spider-Man or one of those movies. And I bit into the tooth and I hit a kernel and it did something to that tooth. And ever since, it's been bothering me only when I eat. But now that he actually said, I think you might have a crack in your tooth. And if we put a crown over the tooth, it'll protect that crack if there is one, even though it doesn't show up on the X-ray. So they put the crown on, and now it's even more sensitive. Like, it's not just when I eat, but like, it's just like a weird pain, and I just need to get it removed or something. And I'm going to cons, so I don't want to fuck with it, while I'm on a 3-day weekend and be in constant pain. That's like the worst thing you could ask for, because the nerves in your mouth are some of the most painful things that you could possibly encounter, like as far
Oh,
as
yeah.
pain threshold. It's just fucking awful.
Yeah, I had, I took real bad care of my teeth, till about maybe 10 years ago.
That's
I'm
about
not.
when I started too, like going to the dentist every 6 months, get the cleaning and doing all that stuff,
Yeah.
And it seems like it went downhill as soon as I took my wisdom teeth out, which the doctor said I needed to do.
Yep. I had maybe about 10 years ago, I went to the dentist for the first time in a really long time. And they wanted me to have all four of my teeth, wisdom teeth taken out. And so when they did that, the surgeon, you know, obviously they numb your whole mouth and everything like that, and the top two came out pretty easily. But then the oral surgeon hadn't expected that the bottom two were impacted because it wasn't when it was exam when I had the exam, it wasn't diagnosed that way. So he wasn't expecting that. So normally they wouldn't have done them all at once, but they he went ahead and took them out, but he was having trouble getting them out, and he actually had to like push down on the top of my head with one of his hands to get leverage to get him out. And
Oh, God.
I was like, later on that night, I didn't sleep that entire night. I was up awake all night because, even with like Tylenol and pain pills, it still really hurt. But yeah, I've had a lot of fun with teeth.
Yeah. So I'm calling the doctor first thing tomorrow. It's gonna be unique because I have like a lot of work to do before I go on vacation, like work. And I hope this whatever happens doesn't take me out for more than 4 hours. Do you know what I mean? But
Yeah,
yeah,
'cause you have to fit it in
we'll
somehow.
see. That's been medical noise where you learn some of the medical history of those.
It's retro because
Retro,
our
because
bodies are
10 years ago we
deteriorating.
started to go to the dentist, and that's our threshold, 10 years.
And our bodies are deteriorating like old comics.
Yeah, they are, unfortunately. All right, we have a kind of a related email who from somebody that's in I believe Canada. And I don't know if we can see iTunes reviews from Canada. It's one of those things. If people leave us iTunes reviews, we can only see this, the country that we're in.
American.
Yeah. So he sent an email and he said he did leave a review, but it's not showing up. But his name is Brian Regate, and it's titled DC Noise and Geek Brunch Are Awesome. And he says, after listening to your various podcasts for several years, I finally got around to posting an iTunes review for DC Noise and Geek Brunch. Problem is, I hit the submit button and did not see my reviews appear along with other listener reviews. I'm not sure if there was a problem with my connection to the iTunes store and did not see it through successfully. I thought I would email you to express my appreciation for the work you do, Keith, Daryl, Micah, Bill, and Chris. So
Nice.
it's related to all of us. It says, podcasts like yours inspired me to start up my own podcast, and I hope you agree that inspiring others to start up their own shows is a pretty good legacy for a podcaster. And yes, it is. It's an
Definitely.
honor. And he says, keep up the great work. I'm loving the Noise Bite shows, especially the part where you take the time to go over first appearances of characters who are showing up in their weekly books. Well, thank you, Brian. And I'll forward this to all of my other co-hosts because you did mention everyone by name. So thank you.
Does he say what his podcast is, or?
No, but I'll follow up. This email is like hot off the press. I just got it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, if he wants to let us know what the show is, can.
Yeah, we can put links on both the Geek Brunch site and the DC Noise site. We're all for promoting comics and especially positivity among comics.
Yeah.
We love the medium. All the co-hosts. Well, Keith's going through a dilemma right now, but he still loves comics. He's just in a different era.
Yeah, he still loves the medium,
Yeah, he
but
still loves the medium. So, yeah. So, thank you so much for the email. I love to get feedback. I mean, I personally love because you don't know who's out there, and the only way you really hear from them is sometimes an iTunes review. But then you can't put. You don't know who that person is. The emails are very nice. Very cool. So let's talk some comics. Or do you need to
Yes.
take a break?
No, I'm good.
All right. I'll, do you want me to start off?
Sure.
I'll just continue where I left off the last episode. And I continued with this Bane of my brother's storyline or whatever this is going on. It is this comic, I am finding so much enjoyment out of it, not just historically because I missed it because I didn't know this arc existed that Bane thought he was Bruce's brother, and but it is an interesting time in the Bat Family universe because it's exactly the opposite of what we're seeing in the New 52. And what I mean by that is that this time period, it really felt like a Bat Family. Cassandra was Batgirl, Dick Grayson and Tim were involved in this book. Alfred was always in it. It really felt like a family book, and all the characters were linked together, and I really enjoy it. I'm still enjoying the other stuff too, but it's like, almost like a deconstruction of what this, I mean, it's the opposite of what this is. The scene opens up with Bane, and he's on a cruise ship near Santa Prisca, where that prison that he came out of. And he meets up with another weaselly guy in a Hawaiian shirt on the cruise ship that also broke out of that prison with Bane. And they're talking about their past. And he knows something about Bane that Bane doesn't want to get out. So he actually takes it's the photo, it's actually the photo of Bruce's father with Bane's mother, and he hands him the photo because this is a flashback. And as soon as he hands him that photo, he throws the guy overboard and he gets eaten by sharks. And then he picks up on his woman and finishes the cruise off, which is kind of interesting flashback. And then you have this cut to Cassandra and the Barbara in the Oracle Tower, and Cassandra's getting restless. Cassandra was very tied in with Oracle. She was like the mentor to this Batgirl. And they're trying to research also Bruce's relationship to Bane because they know Bane, they don't, nobody trusts Bane. And they're trying to figure out for themselves what the linkage is. And Cassandra's getting very uptight because she says, you know, while everybody's undercover outdoors, we're sitting here on the computers and wasting our time, and she's getting very impatient. And then we have a scene cut to Huntress and Nightwing, and Huntress is just pissed off. She's always had this relationship with Batman that hasn't been very good because he doesn't approve of her using a crossbow and sometimes being a little more lethal, I think. And she thinks she's doing just and no different than anybody else in the Bat family, but they've always had a weird relationship. And she actually punches Bruce and or kicks him in the face, and she's like, how can you let this character Bane, because Bane has like broken his back, he's destroyed Gotham in the past, he's raised hell, and she's just upset with Batman. But the cops show up and break up this little meeting between Huntress, Nightwing, Batman, and Bane. And very interesting scene here because during this time I remember that Dick was seeing Helena before he got back with Barbara. So Dick always couldn't keep his dick in his pants. He had a thing with Helena too. And Bane is very observant. He's such a cool character. As they swing away, he says, "This Huntress and your second, they have a history. They move together like lovers." And Batman says, "Ridiculous." But they were. So just by looking at their movements and stuff, he could guess that that was happening. That was pretty amazing. And then
And
there's this.
you
Go
gotta
ahead.
say, come on, Bruce. Like,
Yeah.
do you know who we're talking about here? Like, this is Dick Grayson. Like, have you been paying attention? Like, I don't think you'd be shocked he's connected to any female in the DC universe.
Right. And then there's this reporter guy that, for whatever reason, this is the one part of the story I can't get. Maybe it's in previous issues and I just don't remember them. But he's investigating, he's trying to make that linkage that Bane is related to Bruce, and he wants to pay his way and for people to falsify that information. And we also have that tattoo artist thing going on. Bruce was dating. I made a mistake in the last issue. Now I have to go back and read some of it because I got confused. He's not actually dating the tattoo artist. He was dating the lady that was displaying the tattoo stuff in her gallery. So the tattoo artist is the one that was raped, not the woman that Bruce was dating.
Okay.
So she was raped, and she actually turns into a female tattooed man, which is pretty freaking cool. It's like she tattoos all these vi guys that raped her, and that's how she's seeking vengeance. Is as soon as they leave with these awesome tattoos, they're all happy of. She gets on her computer and then controls those tattoos to kill them, which is pretty cool. And Tim is like investigating the murders, and he finds out there's little nanites in these tattoos with Bruce. And what else is interesting in this? Bruce and they actually have a fight in the cave. Kind of, it's not as dramatic as the Dick Grayson and Bruce fight in Nightwing number 30, but they have their own fight, and this is at the time where they think they might be brothers, so they fight in the cave, and Alfred comes in. Alfred is just, he wants those results so bad because he doesn't want pain in the cave. Alfred is, he thinks it's the wrong thing to do. At this time, Dick Grayson and Barbara are really seeing each other hot and heavy. Matter of fact, they show Dick taking a shower while Barbara's got a towel over her head and she's watching him shower. So
Whoa.
that's interesting.
Wait, so he had been with Huntress prior to this
Pri
then?
prior prior to this,
Oh, okay.
prior to them getting back. Bruce actually calls his girlfriend that he stood up, Kimmy, who owns that, art studio or whatever, and he asks for Aradane's number, and Aradane is the tattoo artist that was raped, because he's kind of putting the two and two together, knowing he needs to go after him. Bane goes to the hospital where they're going to give the results, and Leslie Tompkins is there, and she has just a couple of panels, and she says, "Oh, Bruce, I'm so sorry." So this one leads like the results come back, and they are brothers at this point. And then the tattoo artist is getting revenge, and that's how the issue ends. So they leave you on a cliffhanger, like they might be brothers, and Bane runs into that artist again. And in the next issue, oh, these Brian Bolland covers are fucking amazing. I don't know if you've seen them. I posted them on the site.
Yeah, I saw your.
Yeah, they're just amazing covers. He's such a good cover artist.
Yeah.
But this is interesting, is there's on the Trigate Bridge near Gotham City, Barbara and Dick are in a car and they're stuck in traffic. And all it This issue just has banter between them. It's fucking fascinating banter. They have a discussion about relationships. They're playing like 6 degrees of a character, and they're like starting a list of like to get to the red B, and he like links it from. Let me see. Who does he link? This is such a great scene. I love it. And this is what's missing in the New 52 is legacy and.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, Black Lightning was in the Outsiders with Batman, who was a member of the JLA at the same time as Black Canary, who currently belongs to the Justice Society alongside Wildcat. Once a teammate of our man, the first guy that is, who also served with the Freedom Fighters beside the Red B. That's Black Lightning to Red B in less in 6 degrees of separation. And Barbara says, I can do it in three. I just fucking love it. God, I
That's an
love this
awesome
book.
idea.
Yeah, I just love this book. And in this issue early on, we learned that the cliffhanger in the last one was Leslie Tompkins saying the results are ex as expected, and she calls Alfred immediately to say they're not brothers. So the It's conclusive. They're not brothers. The blood tests are not that. But then that Bane runs into that reporter, and it looks like he throws him off the building, but he says he didn't. And I don't know why. I think Bane was the way they're portraying Bane in here is he really legitimately thought they were brothers, and this reporter had not, that was corrupting the data. He didn't like him, but he's trying his damnedest to get a hold of Bruce and say, "Hey, you're not brothers." And he meanwhile he's at that artist's house. He actually gets to that tattooed woman's parlor, and she's describing how she was raped, and he's doing it as Batman, and he's trying to stop her from killing more people and seeking vengeance. And then there's an awesome conversation between Bane and Leslie Tompkins. And she actually puts her arm around him because he's actually depressed they're not brothers because he feels like he's got no one. And then another wonderful conversation between Dick and Barbara in the car. They're talking about Bruce is she's talking about statistical breakdown with pie charts and bar graphs about her hypothesis that Batman, get this, Batman is the cause for all the villains in Gotham. And then Dick says, I'm not saying this is fact. It's just this theory. It's an actual theory." And he says, "Batman does not create the problem. He's inadvertently enabling criminals just by being there." Oh, he's not inadvertently creating criminals by being there. And then she says, "First, use your indoor voice. I'm right here," because he started shouting. And she says, "Second, we all know the Joker story. Bruce literally watched Harvey Dent become Two-Face. Heck, Bane f first came here to Gotham specifically to take Batman down." And he says, "Oh, I'm sorry I yelled. I just can't buy into a theory that Batman makes it worse. If that's the case, why else would we be here?" And she goes, "That's why it's called the uncertainty principle." I just th this is fucking awesome dialogue. This the creative team, by the way, is Scott Beatty, and the artist is Roger Robinson. The story arc is so good. And then it looks like the artist is gonna inject herself with the actual, because she doesn't have the nanites in her system to become the tattooed woman at the time. She's just using those to tattoo villains and then have the tattoos kill them. So she injects herself with the needle and all the nanites are in her system, and that's how she becomes the tattooed woman. And he was actually trying to link. It's so cool as the legacy of DC characters, because Batman like knows that this tattoo murders are happening, and he starts investigating the tattooed man, which is fucking awesome. He's like, "How's this happening?" I just love this stuff. And then one of the villains that she was trying to kill in her apartment hits Batman in the back of the head, and Alfred loses calm to Batman as he was about to tell him, "Bane's not your brother." And he gets really worried. He's like, "Oh shit, I need to call somebody." So he tries to call Tim. He's busy fighting somebody. He tries to call Cassandra. She's busy. They're stuck on the bridge. Dick Grayson and Barbara Gordon are stuck on the bridge, and a cop knocks on their window, or no, a firefighter, and says, "You need to get off the bridge. There's a chemical spill that could give you guys cancer if you don't get away from here. You need to leave as soon as possible." And she says, "Well, can I get my wheelchair out of my car?" And he says, "You don't have time for that." So Dick actually has to carry her off the bridge. And then this conversation with Bane and Leslie Tompkins is awesome. I'm not going to go into the detail of that, but Batman fights with the new tattooed villain, and she gets away, and she's still loose at the end of this. And there's a little dialogue between Bane and Batman at the end. He actually rescues Batman at the end of the. Batman's gonna fall off the building when he's fighting with that tattooed artist, and Bane grabs him by the foot and saves him. So you think he's like legit, and they were like forming a relationship. And as he gets back to the cave, he logs in the Ardeline Pinkston into the database, who's the new tattooed woman. And that's how it ends. And then you have some black and white stories that I'm not going to go into, but man, this is like awesome shit for a 275 cover price. So much story.
Yeah, it sounds like it. The Barbara and Dick conversations almost sound like they're the fans in the
Yeah.
story. You know, like they're having some conversations that fans might have in
Oh
the real
my
world, you know?
God. God, even like the 6 degrees of the
Yeah.
characters, you know, people do that all the time.
And that thing that they're talking about with Batman too is almost kind of like one of the classic debates
Yeah.
about Batman and the villains, you know?
Very classic debate.
But it also makes sense as something that people that are involved in his life would talk about too, you know? So it's interesting to have two of the closest characters in his life talk about it.
If you could find this arc, I think you'd really enjoy it. Even though I told you the premise of it, just absorbing it in art and story, it's just so good.
Yeah, when it comes to
Really
older
good.
stuff, I mean, spoilers don't really matter to me, I think. You know, like for the most part, you're reading, like you can go back and read some of the classic storylines that everybody knows what happens. And if you haven't read it for yourself, you can still enjoy all the nuances of, if it's a good story, then part of what's enjoyable is the story being told, you know, and just having someone reiterate what the plot is and what they thought about it. You could
Right.
still have something out of it for yourself, I feel. You know, but yeah, that's cool. 'Cause that series is kind of like up and down, you know, I think. Wasn't like Gotham's Knights had a lot of different creative teams, didn't it? I kind of feel like.
I believe it had quite some this was the Roger Robinson arc, and he was, or not, that was the artist. It was the Scott Beatty. But it had a lot, and I think the goal of Gotham Knights was to be more of a Bat Family book, and it really does a good job of that, in my opinion, because every issue I've read to date has had linkages, you know.
That's cool.
Scott Beatty, Devin Grayson wrote some. She wrote the arc before the one that I talked about last. Chuck Dixon, Greg Rucka had a few issues. A lot of Devin Grayson. So we had a
Yeah, that's
female writer on this
cool.
book up until Scott Beatty took over. And then towards the end, AJ Lieberman is the writer. But man, it's really good stuff. I'll probably tackle the next arc just to keep, if my ADD doesn't kick in and I pick
Yeah.
something else, but it's fun. I really had a good time.
Yeah, I like the sometimes I'm almost more interested in the Bat family than I am directly in Batman himself, you know?
Yeah.
All the supporting characters in Gotham City and everything. And I think that was one of the cool things about the Batman and Superman family books when they were coming out back in the day. Because if you're a fan of that group of characters, you buy one comic and you get stories about all of the different characters, you know? In that family, so stuff that is kind of related to it. I mean, that's one of the things I kind of actually to briefly mention a current comic is that kind of liking about Batman Eternal is because I'm a fan of Gotham City overall and just all the various interesting different characters that relate to that city. I feel like, you know, it's you're not just getting what Batman's doing in Batman Eternal. It's really more like Gotham Eternal, and you get this overall story of all these different characters in the city, you know?
You just nailed it
So,
on the head why I love that book so much.
yeah.
It feels like this. I mean, it feels like this, and that's what has me so excited about reading this issue. I just adore Batman Eternal. Like, and I'm feeling the same vibe. I am reading each Batman Eternal twice. I'm reading each Future's End twice. And On both of those books, I can honestly say the way I feel the first time, I actually enjoy it more the second time. Like, I'm just loving it, you know? Because I'm starting to see more of it. I'll tell you one thing, I'm getting my money's worth on these weekly series.
Yeah, if
Yeah.
you read it twice, you know. Feels like the first time.
That's right, Foreigner. Hey, there's one of my favorite bands. One of my favorite albums of all time, Foreigner 4.
Nice.
But that one's not from Foreigner 4, but I love Foreigner.
I
God.
know what songs are Foreigner, but I don't know what songs are on what albums, I don't think. I think the main thing I ever listened to was like a Greatest Hits collection or something.
Yeah.
So it kind of they're all mixed up in my head, which is
In my
which.
opinion, and this is my opinion, Foreigner 4 was better than Foreigner's Greatest Hits. But you know how
That's
sometimes
cool.
music is very impressionable on your life, depending on where you're at? Like, in high school, man, I just loved Foreigner 4. It was everything.
Well, and I'm definitely more of a fan of albums. Like, that's kind of a rarity for me. I don't listen to a lot of greatest hits just because I like to hear, especially back in like in
Oh,
the older days of rock, like they
back in the day, you couldn't buy singles usually. You buy the
and
whole album
they
and you come invested in that album.
right. And they made the albums to be listened to that way, you know?
And I think it, I hate to say this, but I'm gonna sound like an old fart, but
That's what the show's for, though.
yeah, I think it was it developed more quality albums rather than singles.
That makes sense, though.
At least in general, like in the 80s, you had a lot of one hit wonders in the new wave. And I'm a big new wave type fan. But there are bands that came and go and they just had the one song, which is kind of like the iTunes paradigm now, where you don't necessarily have to buy, you just listen to something, you can buy that song. But there's still certain bands that I trust. Like, I know if a Reliant K CD comes out, I'm going to buy it. I know if it's a Blink 182 or any of their incarnations, I'm going to buy it. Even Unheard, because they haven't let me down to date. But, and then on the countryside, like Kacey Chambers, I'll always buy her because I know I'm going to like it. But other than the go-to bands, I'll pick and choose songs. Like I might explore some as far as like go listen to samples of the rest of it and say, does that register with me? And if it not, I'll just buy the single.
Yeah, I actually, my music listening has changed a lot because of technology. Because I mean, most of the time now I have like just a Spotify subscription, and it costs about the amount of a CD, and listen to pretty much, I don't own any of that music, but I can listen. It's like Netflix. I can listen to as much as I want to,
Yeah.
you know. But yeah, I mean, I think sometimes it depends on when you hear it, and you're impressionable when you're younger and stuff, and that music's going to mean something to you. But also at the same time, you know, back when the main way that you bought music was to buy an album, you know, in the later things used to be about singles back when they sold a lot of 45s and stuff. And you see that like the beginning of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones careers and stuff. And then you see the transition in their work where they were more focused on making an album, and there would still be singles off the album, but they thought about, you know, people sitting down and listening to it as like more of like a artistic thing. And you know, you had that through the 70s, and you know, it persisted somewhat in the 80s, but you also had like the singles and the one hit wonders and stuff because of the rise of like MTV and the popularity of MTV videos and stuff. But then you had it swing back again because of like in the 90s with like alternative and grunge and stuff, and like when Nirvana and Pearl Jam and all them got popular and
Yeah, I think it's very cyclical. Like,
yeah.
and then it might even go towards genres too. Because like the other bands that were new wave that I don't consider one hit wonders that I'd always follow and I still followed like Depeche Mode. I would always get like Depeche Mode, New Order, bands like that.
Oh yeah, I mean
The
Depeche Mode, like
Cure like was always a go-to for me. So
Those are
yeah,
all obviously not one hit wonders because they all had a lot of hits.
yeah, there were the opposite of like, I said the new wave was a lot of one-hit wonders. There were some bands that were making a lot of hits,
Yeah.
and not only that, but they would have like two, three, four songs sometimes on the radio. Like another one of my favorites was REO Speedwagon's High Infidelity. I just love that CD. And I can hear it over and over again. It's just a time of my life, like Journey, Escape, Van Halen's 5150. It's weird. There's certain albums I remember, and I like played them so much that I knew what the next song was. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, I know exactly what
You'd
you mean.
hear it and you'd automatically start singing the next song before it even
Right. And
started.
then when you hear the song on the radio and the next song is just a single by somebody else, it sounds weird
Yeah.
because you could start hearing the next
You're like,
song on the
what the
album in
fuck
your
just
head.
happened?
You're so you're singing the next song on the album and
Yeah.
meanwhile something else playing on the radio. Yeah, totally. But I always, because my dad's a big music fan, so I always listen, like I had kid music, but I also had adult music right from the beginning. Because I would listen to my dad's records and tapes and stuff. So, while I had like the Chipmunks Christmas album and stuff, I also used to listen to like the Police, Synchronicity, and like Genesis and Mike and the Mechanics and like all that kind of stuff, like Tears for Fears and stuff, because I liked music and I want to listen to my dad's music and stuff. So, like when I was a little kid, I was listening to all that. So I was always into music in elementary school. I got into like hair metal and hip hop and like I just always my taste changed throughout the years as I was growing up. And then at a certain point, I stopped going through phases with it. And I just like now I just like all kinds of music, But you grow up with it, and certain things stay with you. Like you memorize certain things when you're a kid. And for some reason, you just never forget it, So, like, this kid in my neighborhood, he had the tape of, we always used to, like, kids that I played football with and stuff, we always used to listen to DJ, Rob Bass and DJ Z Rock, that, like, the album that had It Takes Two on it. So we used to always play that stuff, and, I could never hear that song again, and I'll always have the first verse of it and memorized in my head. I memorized it when I was a kid, and I can just still bust it out. Like it's like I guess it's there permanently.
For me it's like Foreigner 4, like Jukebox Hero. I can sing
Oh
that
yeah,
song.
that's a really good song.
I can sing that to the If I had to karaoke that, I wouldn't have to look at the words.
Yeah, I have to look at the screen. You could like turn it. You could turn your back to the screen. Like,
Yeah.
look, mom, no hands.
Look, no hands. That's right.
With stars in his eyes. All right, so I guess I should go talk about one of my comics. Yeah, and that works out because I checked. We didn't have any questions. 28 people saw the post, though. So 20, you have 28 people. What's wrong with you? It's funny how it shows you that, and then it tries to get you to pay to boost it. I don't know what that would even do. It's dumb. So, the Martin Pascoe comic I mentioned.
Hello? I just lost you.
Did you lose me again? I got an
Yeah,
internet connection problem.
that is weird because I thought because you hosted the call that it might fix that, the outages that we usually get.
Yeah, that's why I went ahead and called you.
And that was the first time I wanted to try it, and I said, "Oh shit, this is working. I'll just have Daryl host, from now on host the call, if that's it." But I lost you,
No,
and you're just starting about the Martin Pasco, and then I couldn't hear anything.
And I also started peeing all over my keyboard, so I don't know if that maybe affected the
It's
internet or I don't know.
urinated. Why you? Why'd you do that?
I don't know.
You
I
gotta go
just
pee pee really bad.
no. I'm not. I think I got something in my bladder, but it's not. It hasn't reached critical mass.
Yeah, I'm starting to get critical mass, but I think I can make it.
Yeah, I woke up this morning though. Oh my God,
That's what
I
got
never
me
thought I
up
was.
this morning. I'm glad it did though, because I think I would have slept through that first podcast. I was out, man. I was out.
Yeah, I just some mornings you just have to lean your head against the wall because it's gonna take a while.
Like Twiggy.
Yeah, yeah, like just when is it gonna stop? Anyways, so yeah, this is my Martin Pasco comic that I mentioned, and I talked about how a couple episodes ago I talked about how I got a pile of comics from the flea market. That were like mostly 70s DC stuff. I talked about the Metal Men issues on the show. I think it was the episode that Daryl was on. And so this is one of those, and this is a Wonder Woman, volume 1, number 230. It's from April 77, and it's called The Claws of the Cheetah. It's, of course, by Martin Pasco, and the art is Jose Delbo, with Vince Coletta inks and Jerry Sirpy colors. And I didn't know this when I was opening it up, but then I kind of figured it out. This is actually second issue of a new approach to the comic. They were calling it the New Old Wonder Woman. So this actually takes place in the 1940s.
Oh, wow.
So I guess 229, I guess, apparently, the issue before this was actually the first one. And so, like I said, it's 77, and the show was on the TV show was on from 75 to 79. So, I did notice that there, like, at times it definitely had a feel of the TV show in terms of a very kind of classic Wonder Woman, and she does the bullets and bracelets thing. Steve Trevor's in it and stuff. So, it opens up actually with Diana
I hate to
Prince.
interrupt you, but does
No.
this Wonder Woman cover have the buy war bonds on it?
Yeah, the poster in the background, that's
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I had the right cover.
and it's her and Cheetah.
Yeah. I have this issue, believe it or not, but I think it's one I've just procured and haven't read it yet, so.
I do believe you because I know you really like Wonder Woman.
I do.
Yeah,
But when you said the
and you collect
premise
them.
didn't ring a bell.
Yeah, so Diana Prince works for Steve Trevor, and the two of them are at the White House at a gala dinner, and it's funny because there's a bit of a remark on Steve Trevor's the conversation that they have implies that he would have rather had Wonder Woman there as his date, but she wasn't available for whatever reason. She's decided to go as Diana Prince, and Steve doesn't know that they're the same person right now.
Right.
And also there is heiress Priscilla Rich and a man named Maxwell Stanhope, who tells us is a political columnist, and he's an isolationist. So, this is the 40s, so that means that he believes that the United States should stay out of the war. So Stanhope actually feels pretty strongly about this because he tries to attack President FDR. So Diana rushes off and becomes Wonder Woman, and so Priscilla Rich is actually Cheetah, and the whole thing with her is that her becoming Cheetah the cheetah personality taking over, really, and she puts on the costume, is triggered by Wonder Woman. It's connected. So anytime if she sees Wonder Woman, that is what causes the dormant cheetah personality to come out. So they fight a bit, and but Wonder Woman is able to stop Stanhope from harming the president, and the cheetah escapes. So later on, she wants to draw, now that the cheetah has taken control of Priscilla, she wants to draw Wonder Woman out again, and battle her again on her own terms. So she robs this sightseeing boat that's going down this sort of canal type thing in the city, and Diana gets a report back at their, the headquarters where she works with Steve about this, and so she rushes off as Wonder Woman to protect the people, and they have a battle on the boat where Cheetah shoots these projectiles off at her, and Wonder Woman's able to do the thing with her bracelets to deflect them all. But then once the battle falls in, they fall into the water. They fall off the ship. The water slows her reaction time when Cheetah does the same thing, and so one of the projectiles is able to hit her in the forehead. And what that actually does is leaves a mark on her forehead you can only see with infrared light. And Cheetah's plan is to figure out who Wonder Woman really is. She knows that she's connected to Steve Trevor somehow, so she gets a list of all the women that work in the same building and they're that have builds that one match Wonder Woman, and she narrows it down and is able to confirm that with using special glasses. She sees that there's that mark on Diana Prince's head, the place where she hit Wonder Woman with it. So Priscilla eventually ends up getting control over Cheetah again, or over their body or whatever. And that's actually kind of like the woman in the Buck Rogers episode now I'm talking about it. So she, conveniently for Priscilla, this is a little bit of a stretch, but we'll go with it. The Cheetah's keeping a journal of what she's doing. So Priscilla's able to look at that and figure out what's been going on when she hasn't been in control. And she's upset about this, and she thinks she actually plots up against Wonder Woman because she thinks, if I can get Wonder Woman to disappear, then I'll be able to keep control of myself and Wonder Woman won't be around, so it won't trigger me to turn into the cheetah. So I'm gonna send a letter to Diana Prince because she knows now. Priscilla also knows because Cheetah recorded that Diana Prince is Wonder Woman. That I'm gonna send her a letter that she should appear at this I think I'm getting my plot mixed up here. Okay, yeah. Cheetah. So Cheetah sends a letter. Cheetah wants to kill Wonder Woman, and Priscilla just wants her to disappear. And they both know that it's Diana Prince. So Cheetah sends a letter requesting that Wonder Woman appear in a public service film, and that's where the whole buy war bonds things comes from.
Yeah.
And what she's going to have is she's going to have a bomb in the camera that's going to blow up during the filming. Meanwhile, Priscilla, while she has control, she goes to Diana Prince and she hypnotizes her so she forgets that she's Wonder Woman. So fast forward, and Wonder Woman hasn't made any public appearances for a week. And Steve's looking at the newspaper that's talking about this and wondering what the hell's going on and worried about Wonder Woman. But he, it's time for that film to be made. So Steve Trevor goes instead to take her place so they can still do the film because he's a war hero and everything. He's a suitable replacement. So at this point, Priscilla has second thoughts because she realizes Steve's going to get killed now. So she goes ahead and undoes the hypnotism by shooting the same kind of projectiles at her that Cheetah uses. And this causes Diana Prince's reflexes to go, and she automatically strikes the boats and bracelets pose, and that jogs her memory that she's actually Wonder Woman. So she turns into Wonder Woman, but also that, of course, makes Priscilla turn into Cheetah. But Wonder Woman's able to save Steve Rogers and get him out of the way before the camera blows up. And she captures Cheetah and sends her off to a place called Transformation Island, which apparently is an island that's run by the Amazons that rehabilitates criminals that are like mentally ill or whatever. But it was cool. I didn't know opening it up that it was going to take place in the 40s, and I thought it was pretty neat that that was the case.
Yeah, that's
It's
interesting.
obviously pre-crisis.
I wonder what the transition was in, like, I think 229 is when it starts, right? Where it begins in Earth 2 World War 2. So it's on a different Earth. I wonder how they transition from 228 to that.
Oh, that's true. It would make sense that it would be Earth 2, yeah. Yeah, I wonder
But
how long it lasted too.
as you were talking about this, I was kind of like looking at my database, you know, because I have all these issues. I always, every time you talk about it, I like to see if I have the issue. It's one of my
And
pet peeves,
then
but
occasionally I end up getting caught spending money.
yeah, that's true. And I have these issues, and I'm looking at the covers, and they're a really interesting time because you got the Golden Age Flash on a cover, you got the Spectre, like, you know, all the JSA. And I'm trying to see where the bridge is, where it ends, and I don't see a good transition either at the beginning or at the end. So man, I gotta read this stuff. It's
Yeah,
interesting.
I'm looking on DCWikia.com. I'm flipping through. Might be able to tell because it's each time it's showing locations, and they're like all they're Earth 2 and
How is the art?
it was good.
Had Coletta on inks.
the ubiquitous.
Yeah.
But the Jose Delbo art, yeah, I mean it was pretty just classic kind of like DC House style, you know. And you know, you got the old school cheetah costume where it's just a woman in a cheetah costume.
Yeah, rather
Like,
than her being an animal.
right. So sh and you know, like it when you first look at it looks a little silly, but then the whole dual nature aspect of it, I think, makes it work, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's a woman who isn't in her right mind, and so she's compelled to go put this cheetah costume on to run around.
Yeah.
I kind of like it. And it especially works in the setting, you know,
Yeah,
of the 1940s and stuff.
she has the tiger costume go over her boots or her high heels. That's pretty interesting
Yeah.
on the
Very,
cover.
very unique tailorship
Yeah.
there. So
That's good. I like the cover. I wonder if this is the era that I saw the Freedom Fighters with, but I think the Freedom Fighters are even on another Earth, so I really need to go investigate this.
I'll keep flipping through here, see if I can come up with while we're in this episode, if I can come up with when it kind of goes back.
Yeah. Well, I only have
But
one more book.
okay.
It's Unknown Soldier 214 from what can I find? 1978, so a year after your book. This is written by Rob Kanigher, which is a writer that wrote a lot of war books, but it says guest writer, so maybe this was when Michelinie was writing this series. Dick Ayers and Romeo Thangal are the artists, and this is a. The thing about Unknown Soldier, it was very much like Jonah Hex or any of the old stories, and that they were done in ones. So at this time, you could pick up any issue of this and just read it and get a complete story. And this features Mademoiselle Marie, who's a French resistant during World War II. She's captured by the Nazis and being held at Auschwitz, which is interesting because I just watched that documentary for DC Noise about a year or two ago about Auschwitz. And the general is sending the unknown soldier to go behind enemy lines and get into Auschwitz. So she doesn't reveal any plans because she knows secrets that the US doesn't want to get into enemy hands, and they think that if she's tortured enough that she'll reveal secrets. And Mademoiselle Marie, I've read quite a bit, and I don't remember if I first saw her in Sergeant Rock or if it was GI Combat, but I know I've seen her before. And they had a reference to Star Spangled War stories, which was issue 200, where Mademoiselle Marie, an unknown soldier, had a falling out where she blamed him for getting her whole squadron killed and the mission falling wayside. And he references that. He's like, "General, why are you sending me? She'll kill me on sight. If she sees me and she has a weapon, she will kill me. I don't recommend you send me." And he's like, "There's no other way. You're the only one that could go behind enemy lines, disguise yourself, and get in there." And so he agrees to the mission. They get in a B-17 and go over Germany, and they get shot down by a fighter plane and start shooting at the B-17. The unknown soldier and a couple resistance fighters jump out on parachute, but that fighter plane shoots out all the other parachuters, and it looks like the guy's gonna have unknown soldier dead to rights. His plane is going, it's just shooting at him, and he stops shooting, and he goes, "It looks like he knows that his machine gun, the unknown soldier's machine gun, is jammed because he's trying to shoot at the plane while he's parachuting," and he grabs a hand grenade out of his jacket and just throws it. And it's an amazing throw because you have gravity going against you, throwing at a moving plane, and he manages to hit this plane and destroy it with a hand grenade. So it's awesome.
That's pretty
And
impressive.
yeah, he destroys the plane. And the pilot made a mistake because he could have killed unknown soldier, but it looked like he wanted to just run him, get him in the propeller. Like run into him. But if you
Ouch.
think if you got a whole body stuck in your propeller, you would probably risk the damaging your plane and crashing your plane
Possibly, yeah.
with a parachute all tangled up and everything.
Oh, yeah, especially with the parachute.
Unless he was a kamikaze, but it wasn't.
Right.
But as he's parachuting down, the other two guys that he was going with, they're definitely dead. They've been shot up by the plane, and now they're getting shot up by machine guns on the ground, and they're shooting at unknown soldier, but he manages to not get hit, and he fakes his death. And as soon as the Nazi soldiers come by, he pulls out his gun and shoots all six of them. Boom, boom, boom. And then he takes a hand grenade and shoots the or throws it at the car with the machine gunner and blows up that car. And then he disguises himself as a Jew. He puts the patch on himself and he gets sent to Auschwitz, and they're talking about the smoke towers and the smell of bodies dying and all that stuff. And Dr. Mencke's experiments, and Dr. Mencke shows up, and he's like, he's doing, "Okay, you go in the left lane, and you go in the right line, and the left line," and he's dividing up families. And there's a woman with his daughter, and he's like, "You go in the left line," and the mom with her daughter, and she's going, "You're gonna send my daughter into the left lane? That's the gas chambers. Can you send her to the right and send me to the left?" And he goes, "No, I'm sending you both to the left. Then you can die together." I mean, it's pretty cruel.
Yeah.
Awful shit, like really dark stuff. And while he's there witnessing the line separation, he sees Mademoiselle Marie, and they're putting in her in front of the firing squad. They're ready, aim, fire. They're ready to shoot her, and he, unknown soldier, jumps in front of her, and then that's when they realize he's unknown soldier in disguise, and they stop them from firing, and they're like, put him in one of the experimental block rooms. Because he said, unknown soldier's here for a reason. She knows something, and we need to find out what that something is on the secret. And they put him in this room, this experimental room, and that's when they decide to team up for a while. And they actually pretend they're fighting in the because they know they don't like each other. The at least the Nazi general knows they don't like each other, and lets them fight. And unknown soldier pretends to be dead, and as soon as the guards come in, they take out the soldiers and they meet up with a the resistance within the Auschwitz. He's Henrik, and Henrik says, "We have a resistance here, and we can sneak you out." And there's a mole on Madame Marie's face, and unknown soldier takes that mole off. And it's basically looks at it through like a magnifying glass, and it's a map of the where they're making the gas to destroy the Americans, and that gas will kill them even with gas masks. So the unknown soldier and Madame Marie actually he puts on the disguise of the doctor and goes on the top with Madame Marie and says, "Let's kill her because she's betrayed us." And then the real doctor shows up, and they said, "Fire! Anybody gets a medal who shoots them down now." But they like line themselves out with the gas towers so they could destroy the gas towers. That's how they destroy the gas towers. And then they separate, and they say, "We'll meet again. And when the next time we meet, I will kill you." And that's how the issue ends.
Have you read a lot of
Yeah, I love Unknown
that?
Soldier. And one of my favorite comics of all time is, which is very different from this Unknown Soldier, is The Unknown Soldier by Dice Art from Vertigo. God, that's a deep story. I mean, I cried and bawled, and it's made an impression on me. But this Unknown Soldier is not that. It's very serious in context because you're in a concentration camp. But he does go on a lot of missions where he disguises himself. He gets discovered. The basically plot story, which is awesome. I enjoy all of them. Is he goes undercover. They find out his disguise, and then he saves the day.
Which, I mean, that era was kind of common for there to be a bit of a formula to the basic story,
Yeah, an
which
awesome
would be okay sometimes.
Joe Kubert cover.
Nice.
It's got Mademoiselle and Marie on there, and unknown soldier trying to save her, and she's saying, "I'd rather die than be saved by you, unknown soldier." And the other interesting thing I want to point out is I have this thing about page counts because I like to know what page counts are in a book. This one, interesting enough, was a 17-page comic. So I always thought it was standard 22 pages. It's not always 22 pages.
No, because there was a stretch. Well, that's why I find it interesting when people talk about page counts in current comics, and complain about them cutting back a few pages and stuff. And it's interesting that it's not really the first time it happened, because I don't know if it was just DC, but I know there was a long stretch of time where DC cut back a lot of their issues. And like, I know I've read some DC Comics Presents that are, only around 17 pages and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how that fluctuates. Because I used to always think too that the only change that's ever been in page counts for like a standard issue has been downward,
Yeah.
but there's been times where where it's gone down and come back up, and then been even less than it currently is.
Well, there was one podcast I was listening to, and they were talking about page counts, and they were like 32 pages, and I'm like, no fucking way is it 32 pages of comic. And it said, you know how in the previews it says 32 pages? That means 32 pages including ads. It's 20 pages of comic in a standard DC book right now. It's maybe 22 to 24 for a 391, 399 one. So it all depends. They vary. But the 299 is typically 20 pages of comic book.
And the it seemed like at some point the backup stories disappeared for the from the 399 books. Now they're just like a glossy cover and maybe a couple extra pages. But I'm not going to complain because they still have a lot of 299 books. A lot more than Marvel. So the other, I guess we're, but speaking of DC Marvel, I mean, I guess this episode is pretty DC focused because the other thing I have to talk about is DC as well. I decided, I am going to like finish out this Millennium series. I've been dragging it on for way too long. I'm just going to try to finish it out. So I'm going to try to not take the normal time for like three issues because I read six, seven, and eight. So I'm going to try to go through them a bit quicker. So all of these were, as the whole series was, written by Steve Englehart with art by Joe Staton, inks by Ian Gibson. I think one of the issues, seven maybe, Staton did more of like a layout credit. And then Carl Gafford did the colors on these. So, issue six, I noticed that all, so up until the last one, one through seven, they're all single word titles. Six is called Out, seven is called Down, but then eight is called The Rising and Advancing of Ten Spirits. In issue six, we have two groups of heroes, and one of them's in outer space, and that includes a bunch of Green Lanterns, including Hal Jordan, Superman, Dr. Fate, Martian Manhunter, a lot of basically heroes that have wouldn't have difficulty traveling out there, and they've defeated most of the Manhunters in space, and they're after the Headmaster, the Ultimate Manhunter, and he traps most of the heroes in a bunch of space debris, creates like kind of a containment with them for them, and only Superman and Martian Manhunter are able to get out. But they're able to combat him a bit and rescue the other heroes. So what's interesting is that I had to kind of do a little research to figure out what's going on here because Dr. Fate at this time had recently changed who he was, who the identity of Dr. Fate was. And it's not real clear from the comic itself. So I had to kind of do a little Wikipedia reading just to figure out what's going on because in a recent miniseries, so obviously this is not long after Crisis, Dr. Fate had actually become Eric and Linda Strauss. Eric and
Yeah,
his
that was
stepmom, I guess, I think is Linda.
I would recommend that. That's a J.M. DeMatteis Dr. Fate series.
Yeah, actually, I have the, I think it's four issues or something.
Oh, is this the four issue before they launched the
Or maybe at this point they had actually launched the full series. I'm not sure. I have the
Okay.
mini series, but I don't have more
Well,
info I have.
that's a good question. While you're talking, I'll look that up because I have my Dr. Fate database here.
But either way, they're too new at the job to be able to communicate with Nabu, the wizard that give Dr. Fate his powers, and he's actually inhabiting the corpse of Kent Nelson, who's the original Dr. Fate. So he's not able to consult with Nabu, and they end, Dr. Fate ends up actually using the wrong spell, and he puts all of them in danger. He's trying to basically get them back to Earth,
Eric Strauss is a 10-year-old in a man's body. Huh.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize how young he was. So all he can do really, he's transported to Mala's dangerous dimension. All he can do is concentrate their life energies of all the people into two of them, and he can get two of them out of the situation. So they collectively choose Superman and Hal Jordan to represent them. Meanwhile, with the other group of heroes that are on Earth, Wonder Woman comes in from like her recent issues of her own comic, what's gone on there. She's trying to tell Batman that one of the gods, Olympus, it turns out to be Pan, was actually a Manhunter. She doesn't get a chance to explain to him, because when he when she gets near him, he just says, "I don't want to hear it," at her, because something else that's happened off comic is that the Outsiders, his team, have been totally crushed. They didn't do too well, and he's not too happy about it. And Wonder Woman had recently been rebooted, so she's still pretty new to Earth in this crisis, post-crisis universe. So she's thinking to herself, like, man, she's like, maybe I should rethink this whole getting to know humankind thing, because Batman's such an asshole. But he commands Guy Gardner to go with him after Booster Gold, because they think Booster Gold's a traitor, and working with the Manhunters. And Guy thinks Booster's innocent, because Guy, because of recent events in Justice League International, is like super nice guy, innocent Guy Gardner right now. So they go after Booster at his headquarters, and he puts up a fight against them and escapes. So he still kind of looks guilty. And then finally, we check in with the group of people that the Owen and the Zor, I can never remember the name of those women. But the new people,
Zamorians.
Zamorians. Yeah, there you go. You always have to tell me.
I only know because I remember thinking it was so weird that these little blue guys were having sex with these Amazonian looking women.
I know, and I can remember that, but that
I
never helped me with the
it
name
just
for some reason.
I don't know. That's how I always remember.
So all the people that they're recruiting, the South African guy, that the real asshole racist guy, he finally quits.
Diplomatic
And
immunity.
there's a pretty awesome moment where he's calling, and apologies for using this term, but he keeps calling people, black people, kafir. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but that's. I looked it up, and apparently in South Africa at that time, that was basically the equivalent of somebody being called the N-word. It was that incendiary. So he, as he's leaving, he calls John Stewart that, and John Stewart, now that
Is it the
he's
K
been,
word?
yeah,
Kaffir?
kafir. So John Stewart thinks to himself, I've been laying off because this guy was recruited, but now that he's quit, he uses his ring to knock the guy on his ass. So that was a pretty cool moment. At this point, like Floronic Man, he's more on board with the whole project and less crazy, because he's realized that he's a part of the Green, and he's a part of the Green is a part of the Rainbow, and he's kind of connecting that to this whole group that they're trying to put together. So he's in for it. And at the end of the issue, they trap a Manhunter, and Batman threatens to kill him unless he tells him where the rest of the Manhunters are. And all the other heroes are like, "Oh, I hope he doesn't really mean that." And Aquaman's thinking to himself, he's just trying to scare the guy. Yeah, that's it. He's not going to kill him." But they don't really find out whether they do it or not, because Blue Beetle and Mr. Miracle show up at that point, and they realize that, or they reveal that they've figured out that the Manhunters actually have a base inside the Earth. So we get to issue 7, where the group is trapped and the space group is trapped there because Dr. Fate doesn't have the abilities to get them home. Someone says something, well, we better get on with it. We better start hoofing it. And Hawkman and Hawkgirl point out that they're actually 9 light years away from Earth. So Harbinger is with them. She freaks out because she senses something going on at Earth and just teleports away. And the other heroes are like, what the fuck? Like, she just totally left us here. Why couldn't she have taken us? So the Earth group, Aquaman's taking them down, and they find a hatch in the ocean floor that they lift out, and this is the hatch that leads down to the Manhunter base in the Earth. And Harbinger shows up here with them, explaining that she's sensed what's going on because she's tied to the Earth and is like a protectress. With the new Guardians, we see, they're being trained to take over, to be the new Guardians, and but Tom Kalamaku, he's having some issues because his wife is not happy with this whole setup, the way that it's changing him and stuff. And we get a big battle with the heroes down in the Manhunter headquarters. So here's like Booster helps him out, but they're still suspicious of him because they think that he's just switching sides out of convenience. He's seeing that the heroes are getting the upper hand on the Manhunters, and they just think that he's pretending that he was on their side all along. They're not convinced that he's actually a good guy. Somehow, without it really being explained, the space group shows up, and they did something to manage to get back to the Earth. Manhunter's defeated and everybody's reunited. We have both groups of heroes together, and they're reunited with the new Guardians and the Owen and the Zamorian. And the Guardian and the Zamorian, they're looking pretty old at this point. From where they started the series, looking pretty good. They're starting to look pretty wrinkled and deteriorating. But they want the new Guardians to take a tour of the Earth one last time before they're converted, so they can remember the Earth and their connection to it and why it's important. And it ends weirdly where Booster grabs Chang, the Chinese woman Guardian, and saying that he's going to show her just how rotten this world really is. And I've noticed it a bit here and there as I've been reading this, but this transition between 7 and 8 really clarified for me that they hadn't at this point really gotten down the flow of not making you feel like you had to read the crossovers, because when 8 starts, it's clear that stuff has happened and they don't recap it at all. It's not major stuff, but the way that this ends and the next issue starts with number 8, Booster and Chang are back, and everyone's acting like he didn't do anything weird or, not anything. So I guess all of that happened in a side issue.
Yeah, you're like, how did they get from this point to the next?
Yeah, there's no explanation. I mean, but I just kind of went with it. Apparently, this whole tour of the Earth, this last tour for the Guardians, that all happened off. In the crossover issues that week, because it starts off with issue 8. This is where we get the transformation of all the new Guardians. Chang becomes a hero named Gloss. Takeo, the Japanese man, he becomes RAM, as in random access memory. Gregorio becomes Extrano. Betty, South African woman. I think that's where she was from. She actually, so she doesn't become a new hero. She embodies the world. She becomes like a specter kind of spirit. And she's her connection to communicate with the rest of the group is through Extrano, who, 'cause he's like a wizard type.
Yeah,
And,
very
at,
flamboyant.
yeah. Celia, she becomes a hero named Jet. And Tom Kalamaku, when it becomes his turn, he actually ends up declining based on the stuff that happened last issue. He cites his family responsibilities, how he doesn't want to walk away from those. So they offer the place to Harbinger, but she declines as well, saying much she wants to work on her own and takes off. But throughout this whole process, we get it kind of neat where you get the sense that this is a really monumental event by them showing reactions around the DC universe each time one of these heroes is created. Like they show heroes around the DC universe that are maybe similar or tapped into that same similar power set reacting. And the one that I made note of was because it's kind of funny to me is when Betty is transformed, we see Etrigan, the demon, and he speaks a rhyme as he does that goes free, free from the world of man. The world is open to Etrigan, but now the world reeks woman smell to Etrigan, another hell. So because Betty was transformed, now the world smells like woman. He doesn't like these, and he hates that. So I was like, what the hell? And then we get another nice, when it's all over, Jet says, see, this seems sort of anticlimactic, and Batman looks at her and says, I thank God for that. If I were you, there'll be plenty of new climaxes in the days ahead.
They had some fun with that writing at the end.
And I'm like, Steve Englehart, you know what you're doing. Like it's
Sounds like an episode
1987.
of DC Noise.
I know if it was, and I think earlier on in the episode, somebody said something about like, so they like can't stop coming or something like that. I don't know. It was like weird. Something about come, and I was just, like that sort of was the same way as that. Like plenty of new. I mean, it's like it's 1987. I mean, maybe if it was like a golden age comic, I would think, okay, it's just accidental. But I think Steve Englehart knew what he was doing. But they do give
That warrants a post on the Facebooks.
I know I had to I
It's
had I,
one of
I
those
put it
out of context panels. Like I had posted the panels of Dick and Barbara because they just cracked me up. But
Yeah. Yeah, I posted that quote from Batman on Facebook because I it was hilarious. But they do still give Tom Kalamaku some latent powers to protect him. Because they say, you know, people know that you were selected by us and they're going to see you as a weak link, and take the advantage of you. And they're like, well, what enemies would there be? And there's just, you know, there'll be enemies. But we do see a scene here, a couple panels of the South African. We find out that he has a bunker of like all his technology and stuff now that he's returned to South Africa, and he declares that the war against change is now and forever to the death. So I just kind of was curious, having finished it finally. All this time, I didn't really realize, you know, as I flipped through back issues bins and stuff, I've seen issues of this comic, and I never put two and two together that there was coming out of this a comic called The New Guardians. And, you know, it featured this team that the Guardian and the Zamorin created, and it lasted for 12 issues. And then the team made an appearance or two in Green Lantern. I was just kind of curious to see if any of these characters showed up again. I was looking at Comic Book DB. Obviously,
Floronic Man.
yeah, obviously Floronic Man, the characters that were pre-established prior to this event. Tom Kalamaku obviously been around for forever with Green Lantern, and Harbinger was from Crisis, and she made some other appearances. But the ones that were new, after the New Guardians series, Ram and Extrano, the male characters, they didn't really make any more appearances. But the female characters all appeared at one point in a Wonder Woman story. They didn't really none of them made appearance for a while, but like in like the early 2000s, Gloss and Jet made some appearances in Geoff Johns' Green Lantern, like 52 World War III, and some issues of Checkmate, the early 2000s, like post Infinite Crisis series. So, and that's about the last time any of them have been seen. So, you know, this was it was definitely not bad. It was kind of like middle of the road for me. You know, like I'm glad I read it. It's sort of like average, because I like seeing that era of DC Comics, and it is interesting, you know, I keep seeing parallels to post, like the first few years post-Crisis to what we're currently in with DC New 52. They made a lot of changes with Crisis that became less and less severe over time,
You
as they
that's the pattern that's happening.
And I think as
Yeah.
time goes on, I mean, some things that people want back will reappear. I mean, the JSA were gone completely, and then you had them start to show up again with a couple series that didn't last real long in the early 90s, and then by the late 90s you had them back until the new 52.
They were like in limbo fighting a war against Valkyries and stuff like forever. Like that's how they were in limbo, and then you never saw them.
Yeah, for like a
And then you had the
decade.
aging and the de-aging, and it got real complicated. But that's why I don't understand the a lot of hate, because people don't realize that it's always been that way.
Well,
Like
I think a lot of people that are hating on it too, it seems like they were like the so right now, I mean, you may not have a lot of them, but there are people who got into DC Comics with the New 52, and so that's what they know, and they just enjoy it. They don't complain about it. They probably don't even say much on the internet. I think a lot of people that complain about the New 52, they were those people back when Crisis came out, so they have a lot of nostalgia for Crisis and the DC universe that came out of Crisis.
Yeah, that's
But
what Daryl's tries to say over and over again. But it's new for somebody. It's always somebody's coming on board and enjoying it. I just see things very cyclical and in pattern. And the JSA is a damn good example, because I think a lot of people don't remember what the JSA was like, that happened before, like the Geoff Johns run.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, like so New 52 didn't really change Batman that much. Like they left a lot of his, he was always well selling, so they left a lot of his continuity in place. They didn't make much changes. And then, you know, but Azzarello's Wonder Woman was getting a lot of people reacting to like the changes he was making to her origin and stuff, and also with Superman, like a lot of changes to Superman, and it's interesting how that was the exact same thing. I mean, Crisis, you had George Perez pretty much like radically changing Wonder Woman. You had and you had John
Flash,
Byrne radically changing Superman
Wally West, Flash,
popping up,
popping up. You had Green Lantern with the white hair. I was like, yeah, that Dr. Fate, by the way, was the mini that was referenced, but as soon as Millennium ended, or close to its ending, they launched the ongoing. Yeah, so that was Keith Giffen on art with J.M. DeMatteis on writing of that 4-issue arc. I don't remember that arc. I remember the Dr. Fate series that J.M. DeMatteis wrote, the Sean McManus art.
Yeah, so it's interesting, like the parallels and stuff. We'll see how things go on, because as when like when you're reading Millennium here and stuff, there's not a lot of touches of it, but I did talk about that scene with Wonder Woman and Batwoman. I mean, yeah, Wonder Woman and Batman. But then there's also some stuff like where Green Arrow is thinking to himself, you know, these costume superheroes are pretty damn weird, but I guess this is a good thing. I guess I can hack this, you know, hanging out with these guys. You know, so he's, to someone who had been reading like Justice League of America for years and years, where Green Arrow was on the team,
Yeah.
that's a big change. And if they
That's
were reading that,
huge,
they'd be like,
huge.
even if they're okay with it, they'd be like, man, that's weird having Green Arrow not be used to these other
And
heroes, you know.
also going on the road so much with, during the Neil Adams, Dennis O'Neill with Green Arrow and Green Lantern and Black Canary.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah, he had a long
the
history.
comic was, Green Lantern, Green Arrow.
Right. Up until just about 1980, I think it switched back to just being Green Lantern, so.
And I think by dividing your time between the present and the past, like I do, you see things that you don't realize that, and it makes you more tolerable of change because
Yeah.
you're like this shit is always changing, and it's weird.
Yeah, and you see parallels, like the parallels I was just mentioning between Crisis and New 52, and like other things, like just reading this, like it just reminded me, all the stuff with Animal Man and Swamp Thing with the red and the green, and even like the whole, I mean, it dates back to pre New 52, but the whole color spectrum
The
with Green
Lantern.
Lantern, it all, like, that's not like, there's a reference to the Parliament of Trees in here, with Florionic Man and his connection to them, and you realize like Geoff Johns didn't just say, hey, there's green rings and there's a lot of other colors.
Yeah, just imagine reading Wonder Woman. Like, let's just talk about it. You're reading her as a superhero on Earth One, and then all of a sudden you're like, "What the fuck? I'm on a different Earth now." Or if you go to the Dennis O'Neill one where she lost her powers and she's in a white jumpsuit,
Right.
like what just happened to my? That's not my Wonder Woman.
Well, we can look back in that case and see that it's not permanent, But
I
then, like,
just
people act, when stuff changes nowadays, people act like it's going to last forever. Like with Grayson and stuff like that, like none of that ever lasts forever. Like
Oh no.
they make changes to keep things fresh. And then, like, eventually, like once people are used to Grayson, it'll, like, they can make a new event out of him becoming Nightwing again. It's like, or just like look at Superior Spider-Man. Like by the time people got really into like Superior Spider-Man, they're like, right from the beginning, like when Superior Spider-Man number
All
one
that
came out, I
hate,
was like, I'm like, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is coming out in 2014. Like they're, when that movie comes out, they're gonna have Peter Parker back as Spider-Man. There's no way they're not going to. And what happened, like Amazing Spider-Man number one came out like the same week. It's like there's patterns that you can see,
yeah, that is.
But so, Retrocast, it might be about old comics, but as you can see the parallels to the future and the present.
Yeah, you can.
That's my elevator pitch.
Yeah, they could use that as on a business card.
Yeah. Your link to the present. Geek Brunch Retrocast, www.geekbrunchpodcast.com.
To understand the future, you have to look at
Yes.
the All right. I can wrap this one up. You got any other books?
Nope, that was me. I figured doing three whole issues of Millennium and finally wrapping that up would take a little bit of time, so.
Yeah. And I spent a lot of time on Gotham Knights, but god dang, did I have a good time reading it.
I did read, and I'll just mention that I read it, not like recap or anything, but I did read and decided not to recap or write notes down about it, but I read the first issue special of the Green Team.
Ah, how was that? That
It
was Kirby,
was
wasn't it?
weird. No.
Thought it was a Kirby cover.
Maybe.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, it was weird. It was goofy. And there are some aspects of it that probably wouldn't fly today, 'cause it was, there's like three white kid millionaires on the team, and then there's the one black kid that wants to be on the team. Like he's really poor. And he's like a shoe shiner, and he like wants to be on the team, but they're like, you got to make more money. And so the bank makes a mistake, and when he deposits $5, they mistakenly write that he has 500,000.
Yeah.
And before they can realize the mistake, he does like he invests in the stock market and like has like 1.5 million. So they take back their money. He still has this million.
Wow.
And yeah, it's just weird. But they their whole thing is they have people come and present ideas to them, and they decide whether they're going to invest in it or not. And the guy that the issue. The invention that they decide to fund, it's this thing called a pleasure dome. And it's supposed to be like your wildest dreams and stuff. But
That sounds like a good investment.
I know. But this, so the guy that's trying to shut them down, like the antagonist of the story, the thing that they do to take him out is they trap him in the pleasure dome and they like set it to like maximum settings and he gets over pleasured. And the pictures of him in there, it's just like these really surreal kind of panels where you just see him like riding along and there's just these like weird things in the sky and stuff like that. But I think that was censored. I think it was not really, you know what I mean? But I think like in real life that would have been like X-rated
Yeah.
if we saw what was really going on in the pleasure dome. But yeah, that was a weird comic. It's fascinating to me that they brought the Green Team back in the New 52.
Yeah, I appreciate it though. I really like when they bring obscure shit back.
Is cool, but it's just like I
I
wonder.
love James Robinson because he does that so much. I mean,
It just makes me wonder, like I just want to sit in on the meetings where they decide that, and then and if they're like, well, this will probably last 10 issues and we'll get what we'll get a return on it.
I think a lot of it's legal stuff too. Like, I don't understand it all, but if you don't want to lose the rights to something, you might have to put that thing out, you know? Even knowing that you don't necessarily have the right idea or you know, the right pitch, but if you don't get it out, you could lose that name.
Yeah, I think that there is something to that. I don't know exactly how it works either, but I think there's been a lot of that. And like with, I mean, I think they sometimes they do try to make a shot at it and see what they can do to get it going. Like with Star Spangled War Stories, you know, I think that they're trying to both put a comic out that has that title in it, but also see if like by doing the GI zombie angle and putting that as part of the title too, that they can maybe get something going with it, with the whole zombie thing, you know. But
Yeah, I hope so. I
so,
really enjoy Palmiotti and Gray. Like All-Star Western, I love that book, man. I just can't get enough. I
yeah.
just hope this war, I just wish that there would be a war book from the past. I'm not, while I enjoy like what they've done, I prefer like a World War II book.
Yeah, I think I wish there was a market for that right now too. I mean,
Yeah.
even you don't even really see you know, the smaller companies doing war comics. But maybe someday it'll come back as a genre.
Yeah, just like Western, it just barely hangs on.
Yeah. But you know, once upon a time, I mean, even on television, like people got so oversaturated with Westerns, like that, you know, there was all that was on TV was Westerns. It was so super popular, you know, but then people get sick of stuff.
Yeah, I would love for them to take a shot at like the DC romance comics again. See what it's like currently. Like Young Romance relaunched that sucker in the New 52.
It'd be all about like based on the New 52, it'd be all about people breaking up.
Yeah.
Like young breakups.
I am pretty shocked. About the announcement that Rocket Raccoon sold 300,000 copies.
Yeah, that did surprise me a little
I
bit
it
too.
surprises the hell out of me because of the obscure nature. Yeah, I know there's a film, but this is a film that no one's seen, right? And it's a character that is getting popular, but nowhere near But if you launch a new Batman title, you don't even get 300,000 copies. So it perplexes me. Unless there's some awesome retailer incentive. We'll see.
Those people are going to want it because of the movie.
I guess so. It's launching. Either that or Scotty Young's bigger than I ever thought he was.
Yeah, that was the second factor. I was going to wonder if it's maybe a part of it, like Scotty Young. I mean, he doesn't he's mostly does covers, right?
He does a
I mean,
lot of
lately.
covers, but
And then what, the Wizard of Oz thing or something?
he did the Eisner nominate or winner of the Oz books, and they just ended. So, but he has done interiors
Yeah.
for Deadpool and the X-Men in the past. I don't care for his style, but I guess I could see the appeal. Because I know people that love that kind of style, but I'm glad that it's happening. It just surprises me. It really does. How a Rocket Raccoon can outsell, Batman.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I don't think it will continue to.
Oh,
That's what will really
I
surprise me.
think it'll drop like a rock, but.
Yeah.
The fact that it ever got that high, like I would even be surprised if it hits 70,000 on the first order. You know what I mean? Because 70,000 copies is considered a really great thing in today's market. So,
Yeah, outside of your biggest characters, definitely.
yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. I mean, I'm not gonna get it. I mean, the character's funny to me. I like him in Guardians of the Galaxy, and I think, Bendis is a pretty funny guy, and he does well with characters that are supposed to be funny, and I find him amusing the way he interacts with Star Lord and stuff in Guardians. But that's about as far as it goes for me. I don't need like a solo series of him.
Yeah, I'm trying it just for sheer curiosity, but
Yeah.
if it I don't expect it to be in my wheelhouse.
You know, I just read last night, speaking of Marvel, I read the first four issues of She-Hulk,
Yeah.
and I really liked that a lot. That
It
was really
is
good.
really good 'cause it's just sheer fun.
Yeah.
Good supporting characters, a lot going on. I like it.
The covers are awesome. It's like
Yeah.
Kevin Wada, is that right? I don't know, but they're beautiful covers, and it's not really the same style of art that's in the inside, but I like Javier Pulido as well. I mean, I've seen his art on other stuff, and that's kind of like so Scotty Young is kind of cartoony, and so is like
Yeah.
Javier Pulido in a way, and like Chris Samnee, but like I like that style of cartoony more than I'm a fan of like Scotty Young cartoony. Yeah, I like it's just She-Hulk, it really presents She-Hulk as like a really interesting character. And it's written by an actual lawyer, so the law stuff is really, this is cool. Like the latest issue she goes to, which was actually kind of funny because I don't read that much Marvel new. I'm not current on much Marvel. I read it like on Marvel Comics Unlimited,
Yeah.
so it's like 6 months behind. So I'm not current on Daredevil. So she goes Daredevil guest stars in issue four, and like I didn't really expect it to be a spoiler, but actually that kind of spoiled some stuff in the upcoming Daredevil issues for me. But I mean, I didn't care, but it was kind of fun. I'm like, oh, I guess some things are significantly changed for Daredevil at this point.
Are you reading these digitally or?
No, I mean, I don't really buy. I don't mind reading digital, like Digital Unlimited, because it's like a flat fee
Yeah.
and a subscription based. I also like Thrillbent now has like a $4 subscription fee for like $4 a month. You can read pretty much everything on their website.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And actually one
Can you read them on Comixology, or do you have to read PDFs?
you can either download most, it depends on the comic itself, you can download them, or I've just been reading them on my laptop because the way they're formatted, like the Thrill Bands whole thing is that their comics made for digital, so they're like the widescreen format. But you would probably re I read the all the chapters that are available of The Eighth Seal. It's which is written by James Tynion the Fourth, and it's a horror comic. I think you would like that.
I like horror, so.
Yeah, I think you would like it. It's about it's actually she's actually the First Lady of the United States, and she's being like struggling with demonic possession.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty crazy, and they're trying to keep it covered up, but she's like doing crazy shit on television and stuff. And last night I was reading one other one that is called The Damnation of Charlie Wormwood.
Yeah.
I read like 15 chapters of that. They're not as long as regular comics, but that's like almost the exact setup of Breaking Bad, where you have this family of three that's struggling to pay their medical bills.
Yeah.
But the guy, instead of being a scientist, he's just like a English teacher in a prison. So that's how he gets connected. Like he, one of the inmates, starts tempting him to work with him on the outside because he, Charlie Wormwood, he has a photographic memory.
Yeah.
You know, the point I've gotten to, he's only starting to get involved with the criminal activities and stuff. So it's almost like similar setup to Breaking Bad, but he's not sick. It's just his son that's sick. And, you know, he's not making drugs. He's at this point, he's just like a messenger. So, but it's a black and white comic. It's pretty cool. Let's see who the creators are. But yeah, I mean, $4 a month. I mean,
But
it's pretty
She-Hulk, are
cool.
you getting in paper or what?
Oh yeah, so yeah, I'm getting so I don't the whole thing with I don't understand why people are cool with it. I just personally like I don't like the DRM on the Comixology stuff.
Yeah.
I just it just I for me like I just I don't wanna I've thought about sometimes 'cause you can buy with Image Comics you can buy if you buy for them
Subscription.
directly
Yeah.
off their website, you actually get the comic, like you can download it and it's not protected or anything.
Right.
But so I've thought about that. I still haven't. But as far as the Comixology thing, like where you don't actually own the comic, like I don't want to do that. So I've been getting I don't get much Marvel digitally, or I mean I don't get much Marvel but I started getting Amazing Spider-Man when it was relaunched because Spider-Man's always been a favorite when I was a kid. And then I decided to try the first four issues of She-Hulk and Ms. Marvel in paper because those are like two of the few comics that are still $2.99.
Yeah. So what did you think of Miss Marvel?
I liked it too. I mean, I like Adrian Alfana or
Yeah.
Alfonso. I like his art. I liked when he was on Runaways.
Yeah, I like it.
But I think it's I like it. It's you know, part of the controversy or press on it was, you know, that she's Muslim.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting just from like a different cultural standpoint. Like, I
Yeah, you
mean,
get a lot of the culture, I think, at least in the first few issues.
yeah, and it, the writer's really good. I mean, it's not written like a novelty.
Right.
It's just they're
How
just people.
are parents going to respond differently than our parents, you know, things like that.
And in some ways you see how it's the same, you know,
Yeah, and that's
as like
exactly.
a you know, like a white Protestant family or something. So
Yeah.
but I so I like the different like terms and just seeing how the dynamic of that family I thought was it makes an interesting backdrop. But I think Kamala is just an interesting character. Like I find the writing to be well-rounded. You know, the characters seem real. And Kamala, I like how she's a kind of classic Marvel protagonist. You know, like she's like it reminds me like almost like Peter Parker when he like when Peter Parker started out. You know, Spider-Man. Like he's she's not popular. She's kind of nerdy. She's into like video games and like Avengers fan fiction, and
Yeah.
she's not like real confident in her body like at first. Like a little bit of a spoiler, like when she first gets her powers, she makes herself look just like Captain Marvel, Miss Marvel, Carol Danvers, and so that's a white blonde person,
Yeah.
so, and it's just like, well, and so she has cool supporting characters, like she's got cool friends, and how they're like, she's got a nice relationship with a guy that's like could be romantic, but it's not, because at this point, and they're young, but the whole thing of her like deciding to not change her appearance to look like something other than like a Pakistani teenager,
Yeah.
I just think it's cool. I think it's like a lot of people, it could connect with some people that other comics didn't,
Right, I think it offers something different, that's for sure.
Yeah, what I thought was fascinating is like I don't think I've ever seen a first issue of a comic that had tons of letters written to it. Like they
Yeah.
had so many letters, by the time they went to press on issue one, they were able to print like 2 pages of letters of people that just wrote in excited about the comic being published. I don't know if I've ever seen that. And like I didn't read all of them, but I read this one letter that was written in from a girl who is like I mean, she's like around the same age and the same ethnicity as Kamala.
Yeah.
If not same exact ethnicity, she's definitely from like a Muslim family. And like, it was such a touching letter. I almost like started crying because she was so excited. Like, it said something to the effect where, until you announced this comic, I never thought that the idea that a superhero could look like me never even occurred to me. Like I love reading superhero comics about other people that look different from me, and I never even thought a superhero could look like me. And I was just like, that is so awesome.
That is, I gotta read the letters page now.
Yeah, it just gave me chills. Like,
What issue was that appearing in?
number one.
Oh, okay.
Like all
Wow.
the like I just I got to the end of number one, and I'm like, a letters page. Like normally they're just always like announcing that they're
Yeah,
accepting
it's usually
letters,
three issues away or something like
Yeah,
that.
and there's like 2 pages of letters of people that just wrote in based on the announcement of the comic. I was like, damn. I guess they touched a nerve. Like
So she was writing in basically sight unseen, or
Yeah, she was
that she'd
writing
seen some
on
preview pages, or
maybe, yeah, she didn't mention it, but she was just writing based on the fact that they were launching a comic about a Muslim female teenager. And she's a Muslim female teenager, like a family that emigrated like Kamala's parents to the United States. And just the fact that there was going to be this comic, and she knew that the comic was about this girl, and the concept that there could be someone that looked like her, because she looks like Kamala, this real life person. The concept just never occurred to her that a superhero could look like her.
right.
So I thought that was pretty awesome. But
That is.
because it doesn't cross my mind much, like a lot, like most of the superheroes look like me, like not specifically, but there's a lot of white dudes.
Yeah.
So
No, no, no heroes are as fat as me or brown. Well, I guess Paco is the Blue Beetle's friend in the old 50, the old DCU, was as close to looking like me as anybody.
Well, I'm definitely not as muscular.
Yeah.
But I think that was part of like when I read Peter Parker and stuff when I was a kid,
Well, make sure to get the man chichis grown for your dancing at your wedding so you could be ready for that Buck Rogers stuff.
There you go.
Yeah, you come in
But
with a jogging suit jacket, a zipped just barely at the
I'm gonna have to get a Sharpie
bottom.
or something, because I'll have to draw some chest hair, because I don't have that much. I wouldn't have fit in the 70s.
I'm starting to get a few chest hairs. I think it's old age. You start getting hair.
I have like a
I
massive head.
never had hair before on my chest, and now I'm getting like little strands. I have like five strands.
Maybe like while you're sleeping, Barb's rubbing the hair tonic into
Hair tonic.
you. Like, I'm gonna have a real man whether he
I'm
likes it
trying
or not.
to make an ape.
She's gonna market you.
Yeah, I could go work at Planet of the Apes and they wouldn't have to costume me up.
Yeah, you gotta get ready for to be a booth babe at Heroes Con for Keith and
Yeah,
Luke.
and Luke.
Right.
We can wrap this one up. This has been Geek Brunch Retrocast 30 something.
35, I think.
35.
Gotta make this one last for a little while.
Yeah.
Much
And
to be conning.
yeah, we'll come back and talk some more Buck Rogers and some more comics. You can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com. They all start to blend together after a while.
Says
And
Ben Retro Bytes
Retro Bites, yeah.
or Noise Bytes.
No, the bites are meant to be less than half hour.
This is it's like when you get if you get a monthly shipment, it's
Yeah.
bytes.
At MythMakingETC on Twitter and at Mike Myers Brunch. Emails are mike@comicbooknoise.com or at MythMakingETC@gmail. Is that right?
MythmakingETC@gmail.com,
Yeah, gmail.com. What else? Oh, Facebook page is Geek Brunch Podcast. You could search that, click the like button, follow the episode threads there. You can leave comments on the website. Leave iTunes reviews. We love those. They make us very happy.
Yes. Tell us, email us if you're leaving an email on a non-North America in one.
Yeah. And what else? I think that's it.
Eat your vegetables.
Yeah, eat your vegetables.
Well, I thought you were gonna fight me on that
Go
one.
see the dentist.
Yeah, if you haven't been to the dentist in a while, learn from our examples. Learn from our mistakes.
Hate the dentist.
They
God,
should
man.
teach. Floss every night.
That's right. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
All right,
I'll
have fun.
send photos.
Photos.
Yeah, of me.
Oh.
And
I
my nippleage.
didn't think we were going to
My
talk about
Buck
that on air.
Rogers.
I thought that we were going to keep that to the Facebook messages.
I'm actually going to Denver Comic Con as Gil Gerard in that
Nice.
episode. I'm wearing a vest.
Nice.
That's right.
Try to impress the Power Girl
Yeah,
cosplayers.
I'm gonna take a pole, like one of those little posts, and I'm just gonna start dancing and touching the post. Yeah,
They'd be like, "Where's your cold water guy now, Barb?
your ice cold water. It's not only $1. Come
Where's the
get
ice cold collar guy now?" Oh yeah,
it.
blah blah.
Look at me.
Here's Big Jim, the
Must hate the
safari outfit,
beekeeping
his captain,
again.
Captain friend, Big
Ooh.
Josh. Big Jim's on safari when suddenly he sees Big Josh coming at him through the trees. Big Jim says, "Let's see if he's stronger than me." Big Josh cracks this tree stump with his axe. Big Jim splits this board with karate wax. And they realize when the contest ends, the two strong guys are going to be strong friends. Big Jim, Big Josh, Captain Ten, and Safari Outfit all sold separately from Mattel.